I should probably let myself get face hugged at some point just to see that happening.
Hello, and welcome to the Negative World Podcast, a podcast about video games by the Nintendo fans at negativeworld.org. We are recording this on Wednesday, December 28th, 2011. I'm your host, Steven, or as I'm known on the boards, Dr. Finkelstein, and with me today I have...
CPA Way, also known as Way.
This is Matthew, also known as Triforce Bun. Wait, I think I flipped that around. This is Triforce Bun, also known as Matthew, sorry.
I'm Guillaume, otherwise known as Guillaume.
We got through that pretty painlessly. What are you guys going to be talking about today?
I will be talking about the Metroid, since this is Metroid's 25th anniversary, but unlike Zelda and Mario, there's no fanfare whatsoever.
I will be giving that fanfare to Zelda, but also a little bit of razzing because of the new official timeline that just was released. I'll be discussing that, and also Skyward Sword in a very nerdy manner.
And I'm wondering if challenge improves a game, usually, or if a game can be fun without challenge at all.
All right, and then when I finally get to my topic, we'll be discussing the Wii U and just kind of what we hope for this machine that's going to be dropping in the next year. Enough of that. I guess we'll just get started with what we've been playing. Wei, you know, what have you been playing lately?
Lately, I just got myself a 3DS, and I'm starting out with Devil Summoner, Overclocked, Pushmo, and of course, trying to. I just saved myself and Find Me for the first time. Pushmo's been what I'm spending a lot of time on. It's really fun. The puzzles are finally ramping up. I think I'm over 100 puzzles in now. Mm-hmm. Before that, it kind of was kind of like an extended tutorial. I'm enjoying it a lot, though. It's nice how all the little things they teach you kind of build upon one another. And now the puzzle's starting to get really complex. I have to stop and think.
Do you find do you find yourself like really stumped on some of these now? Because going to what Guillaume will be talking about later is, I feel like that game is easy, like you're saying, that tutorial, and then quickly changes over, and there's not a nice curve to it.
But, I don't find myself really stumped yet, and I think they're building up on the little concepts very well so far. I'm not sure if I'm going to hit a spike later. Mm-hmm. I think I'm up to puzzle 100 and I don't know exact number, 108, 109, something of mm-hmm. that nature. And I like how they introduce like little just the regular pulls and pushes, and then add in the ladders and then the buttons that push the colored blocks out. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything. I'm not sure if there's anything else later. I haven't gone that far yet.
Yeah, I'm about the same point that you're at. And I thought that the extended tutorial was a little bit annoying. And I'm kind of... I can't help but think that if this game was made, you know, like 10 years ago, the first time that you encountered a ladder or a button that pushed colored blocks out, it wouldn't have told you what it does. It would just be presented to you, and you would jump on that button or, you know, get on that ladder, and you would see what it does, and, you know, like, you would figure it out. But it's like, I don't like how the game has no faith in you, in the player, in that you'll actually, you know what you're doing once you've done it once.
I kind of agree with that. I find myself getting a little less patient with how games seem to be doing that with more frequency these days. But, you know, that said, I'm actually at around the same spot you guys are in Pushmo. I've just beaten the game kind of lists its world strangely, but I've just beaten the third world, I think it is, and gotten to the next part with various murals and things. And I could talk a little more about it on my segment about Pushmo, but I'm enjoying it a whole lot. And but I did think that tutorial part was a little long, and I think they have two of them where the old man keeps, you know, telling you what to do. And after maybe the first level where you do ladders and do those buttons, you kind of get the idea.
But, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm enjoying the game. Steven, you talked a lot about it last podcast, and I definitely agree with a lot of what you said. Like, it's just a good, simple puzzle game that has a lot to offer. And there's just like these annoying flaws that don't completely prevent me from getting into the game at all. I mean, it's still a good game. It's just a little bit annoying that Intelligent Systems doesn't trust you more, you know?
So what else have you been playing, Wei?
Double Summoner Overclocked, which actually, it's interesting bringing up the tutorial thing, because that game teaches you a lot of stuff. I feel that's kind of more necessary since there's a lot to lot more to the game, from the auctioning of demons to fusions to teaching demons certain skills you've skill cracked from other monsters. So even though there's tutorials there, I feel that it's just the right amount. And plus, it doesn't like overload you and saying like that you can choose these menus to attack, and these are weaknesses and strengths of each monster.
Yeah.
Look at the top screen. Here's a list.
Yeah, game. Oh, sorry. Is that the one that's like a 3D remake of an earlier DS game?
Yes, it is a remake of the original DS game. I think there's supposed to be an extra scenario at the end. I wouldn't know since I never played the original. And a few little minor 3D effects that really don't matter. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah, from what I understand, the gameplay is on the bottom screen anyway. So the 3D effect is, for the most part, non-existent.
Yeah, it's basically there for the menu, not even the regular menu, for the beginning menu when you're just starting to load your game, and when you're fusing monsters. And that's basically it.
Yeesh. I also saw on Twitter, KG Tennis Pro, who's a member on the board, tweeted that he thought he liked the game better back when it didn't have voice acting. Is it really that bad?
It's okay. I've heard worse, sadly. But it's okay. It's bearable. I don't mind it. I don't mind it too much. I mostly go through a text so fast, I don't wait for them to finish their sentences. So,
well, from the Atlus games I've played, which are basically just the Trauma series and Personas 3 and 4, I really like the voice acting in those games. Like, I feel that, especially in Persona 4, they give the characters a lot of personality.
Yeah, though those games have quality voice acting, but I've seen trailers for Devil Survivor Overclocked, and you have to have a high tolerance for bad anime voices, in my opinion.
Oh, one exception, the character Midori is annoying as hell, her voice, so.
Cool name, though. That's my input for the whole game, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, well, like, we talked about Persona on the podcast before, but yeah, Devil Survivor Overclocked is kind of part of that same series with the same kind of ideas. Like, you still deal with demons who fight for you and things like that, except I think Devil Survivor is more of a strategy game, right?
It is the strategy game. The strategy portions are pretty light. A lot of it mainly is trying to go in with the right amount of customization. So the actual, when on stage, the strategy matters less than the customization preparation you do before you go into battle. And it's very fun. When you go into battle, it plays out like your usual turn-based RPG battle where you select from the menu and your party takes turns attacking each other.
Yeah, for those who want to go and listen back to episode 8, Octorokin talked a lot about Persona, and I really recommend it if you've got a device that can play it, like a PlayStation 2, it's also in the PSP. And there might also be a remake for the Vita. I can't remember exactly. One of the Persona games is getting remade for the Vita. But yeah, we'll see.
I think it's Persona 4, if I'm not mistaken. Like Persona 4 Golden or something it's called. But yeah, I definitely recommend Persona 4. It's a good game.
Awesome. I do recommend Double Survivor. I'm enjoying it so far. I hear there's multiple endings. I can see where it's coming from. It's not as... The choices you make in the game is not as deep as, say, I don't think anyone here has played Nocturne on PS2, but it does have a lot of choices to make throughout the game, and you choose, kind of start aligning yourselves with the various different characters with the time allotted to you, since each event you take, time passes. And overall, it's a solid game. I like the customization aspect and the interactions. So, good recommendation.
So, Matthew, what have you been playing?
I've been kind of swamped with games lately. I'm kind of making up for not really playing much of anything for the first part of the year, I guess. Recently, let's see, I've been playing Pushmo, which I'm enjoying a lot. I think Pushmo is really fun. And I wasn't really sure if I was, you know, going to get it or not. It's always kind of, you know, with DSiWare and, you know, 3DSware, WiiWare, it's always kind of a chance you're taking with things. You're never quite sure if it's going to be something that you're into or not. But Pushmo had been getting a lot of good praise, and I had gotten, a gift card for the 3DSware as a gift this Christmas. So I thought, you know, why not? Let me give it a shot. And honestly, it ended up being one of the best games of the year for me. I really enjoy those sort of action puzzle games where you have these separate rooms. You know, in a way, it reminds me a little bit of Donkey Kong 94, for instance. Uh-huh. But, of course, it's a little more puzzle-driven than that. But, yeah, if you guys haven't played Pushmo yet, I definitely recommend it. And it's got kind of a long tutorial. You have to sort of bear with it for a little bit. Sort of that whole Nintendo-y kind of beginning that usually takes a little bit of time to get into. But once you get going, it's a lot of fun. It has an edit mode that I haven't even really, you know, dove into at all yet.
Let me plug the fact that there is a thread on the forums for that, and I'm not the only one, but I've been putting a lot in there in comparison, and people are enjoying them so far, but I want to play some stuff that you guys do, so definitely try to get on that soon. I'm eager.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to... Were you the one that made that big Christmas tree?
Well, with the snowflakes in the sky?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was me.
Cool. Yeah, I haven't really done any of the scanning yet, but I'm definitely going to go to that thread after I probably do a few more stages.
You might need to, because functions of that level builder unlock as you progress through the main game. And apparently, because of what I've been using in my levels, I guess you need like all of them unlocked, unfortunately. So I'm going to try to make some simpler levels, but I just like kind of these scenes that I like to play with. So, yeah, you might not even be able to play some of my levels yet, but... But yeah.
Would you like to plug it anyway, since it's the festive season?
Oh yeah, I mean, totally. You know, if you go to the thread, I've got Bird Circle Mountain going on there, which is some weird like mountain I just wanted people to climb. And then there's the just the Christmas tree one with the snowflakes. And then I just made another one, which is like a night sky with a tree. So I guess actually that's kind of a similar concept.
It was the night sky one with like the stars in the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at that and I was kind of wondering how do you climb that? But I guess I'll have to scan it and find out.
Yeah, it definitely works. Like how, I guess not to cut into your time here as you discuss this, but my method for creating the levels is pretty much just making a scene that I want to make and then just testing and playing and seeing what I would do naturally. And then when I come into a spot where I'm stuck, I think, okay, well, what could I do here that's kind of neat? Whether it's involving pushing blocks or just making like a leap of faith across the top of something and and then I make that fix, and I just kind of keep testing and testing, and then until I have a finished route. So hopefully these are challenging, because to me they seem very easy, but I think I'm trying to be crafty. I guess I don't know. But I know the solution.
I mean, you made them, yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully that's fun for you guys. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's cool how you can how you have that sort of mentality when building a level. I think a lot of people do that. And I think it's a testament to the game's design, where they take something that's, you know, it's just a simple core idea, and you could do so much with it. And use—I think they mentioned it in the last podcast. Use these old Nintendo sprites in all new ways. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know. It's a delightful little game. So
yeah,
definitely check out Pushmo. I've been playing the Game Boy Advance games. I beat WarioWare. Very fun. Very very short, but a lot of unlockables. A lot of little fun things. Minish Cap. I'm currently playing, and. It's a solid Zelda game, but I think it's, you know, it doesn't get a whole lot of recognition because I think it was right after the Oracle games, and I think it released the same month as Resident Evil 4, if I'm remembering right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely check it out. It might actually be my favorite of the Ambassador games when all is said and done.
Is it your first time playing?
No. I've played the Minish Cap before, but I've also been playing Rayman Origins, which I've posted impressions of that before, but to do a quick recap, I'm definitely enjoying it. I'm in the middle of the third world, and it's pretty crazy. It's got good music. I definitely agree with Guillaume when he mentioned that it felt a lot like Donkey Kong Country Returns, because there are numerous elements that give it that feel.
Absolutely.
I really like how you have this sort of momentum going through the stages. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a lot of Donkey Kong Country. Like, you'll slide down some rapids, you'll bounce off a mushroom, you'll bounce off enemy heads and grab all these lums in the process. And it's perhaps most exemplified in the, I haven't gotten too far, but so far it seems to be the penultimate stage of each world is sort of this bridge made of these creatures that you save. And you're kind of going across their very long hair. It's really weird and hard to describe, but it makes sense when you play it, and you're basically trying to keep this combo going, getting all these lums. And it's definitely a well-designed game. I'm having a little bit of problem with the controls, and I think that the way deaths work is a little strange to me, because I'm trying to get everything in one go, you know, and you basically have a checkpoint after each room, which is, it's fine, except I find myself killing myself a lot to get a perfect score. And I feel like there should be some sort of penalty for that beyond starting the room over.
I don't know. Like, I actually kind of like that. I mean, I'm not sure if I would want a penalty, because then you would have to do the whole level over and over again. And I don't see that as a good alternative. Like, that's one of the things that I hate in games when you've got, like, an exploration-based scoring system, and then, like, if you miss one thing, then you have to start the whole thing over, and you have to collect all the stuff you've already collected, and then remember, okay, I've got to pick that one thing that I forgot last time.
Well, that's true, but in Rayman Origins, you have these, you know, you have those moments where you hit the big lum, and it kind of does that ba 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 da ba da ba da ba. You know, you gotta get all the pink lums are worth double, so you have to hit them all, and it's not easy to do the first time often, because you know, you're going through the level for the first time. So you either have to make a choice. You say, okay, I missed a couple lums. Should I kill myself and go for perfection? Or should I keep going and hope I can still reach the target? And I guess a little too often, I would decide to keep going, and I've missed the target by one lum before. And it's just like, I got to do that whole, I got to explore the whole level to its fullest again. So I don't know if it's really a design flaw or anything, but it's, I feel like it's not the ideal system exactly.
Well, I don't know if this is good news or not, but I think that kind of goes away in the later levels. I found that they were more generous with the lums and they gave you more of a margin of error, or they just became more like, it became more natural to me to get like a good score during one of those combo things. But yeah, like I would regularly in many of the later levels just overshoot the target by like, you know, 30, 40 lums, which was unthinkable in the earlier levels because you could barely scrape by when you were doing your best. So, I don't know, like, keep playing. And like the first levels are the ones where, you know, that particular aspect is the worst.
How much content is in this game?
It seems pretty beefy. I'd say I'm not actually sure of the number of worlds. I've kind of been avoiding that information, but if it's got a similar number of worlds as Donkey Kong Country, I'll say that the levels feel kind of as beefy as Donkey Kong Country Returns in terms of things to get, hidden things, and time it takes to go through them. It's got a lot of variety, so it seems like it'll take a while, and they have time trials, which I like. I'm a fan of that.
Well, if, you know, in a game like this, I didn't really think about this until Donkey Kong Country Returns, but time trials are really fun when the level itself is fun to race through. And that's what DKCR was all about. And from what I've heard from, you know, Guy and everyone about Rayman Origins, it seems like this is the same kind of game. I do want to plug really quick just to get it out there. I'm looking at it right now on Amazon, and it's $29.74. So that's a pretty good price for this
game. Oh, for the
Wii? Yeah, for the Wii one.
All right.
And it's like 28.24 for the other versions, but...
Matt, what do you think of the Wii version? Like, have you seen at all the HD version? Like,
I The only time I've seen the HD version in person was during very briefly at E3. I didn't get to play it, but I feel like for the HD visuals, I do feel like there's something missing a little bit in the Wii version. Unlike in games like Kirby's Epic Yarn or Wario Land Shake It, which are built around the Wii, I do feel like I'm kind of missing out on a sharper version of Rayman Origins. But the game's still totally playable and it looks really good. It's just sometimes it kind of zooms out a lot and the text is a little hard to read, you know, most of the time. So, I'd still say it's a great game, but if you want to spring for the HD version, and did you say it was like $10 more?
Right, yeah, now? Like $38 for...
$38, so like $9. Yeah, I haven't played it in person, so I can't...
I've played the demo, and I would say it's worth it. I agree absolutely with your assessment that the game is not really... It doesn't look quite as good as, or as optimized maybe, as games made for the Wii. Like a Boy and His Blob and games like that seem more vibrant. And for some reason, Rayman seems a little bit more dull. Maybe if you're willing to, you know, turn up the brightness setting on your TV every time you play it, then that's more acceptable. But actually, like I did play it on two different TVs. Including the uncalibrated TV at my parents. And the picture was brighter and it was a little bit more pleasing. It was almost as colorful as Kirby is. But I agree that there's something missing. I would have sprung for the HD version if I had known.
I don't have much time left right now. Oh yeah, I don't have much time left, but real quick, I want to mention that I've been playing Swapnote. Which is fun. I'm sure most of y'all have been playing that. And Photo
Spam
Dojo.
Note?
Yeah, Spam Note. Right. And Photo Dojo, which I picked up on a whim for $2, and it's pretty hilarious.
I got it for free.
Yeah, Photo Dojo for free. Man, I made fighters of me and my brother, and I drew a bunch of poses to make Butthead. So now I have Butthead fighting me. And soon I'm going to make Irio from Brawl in the Family. So I'm having a lot of fun with Photo Dojo. The gameplay is, you know, nothing special, of course, but I don't know. It's just that gimmick is just kind of fun, especially for $2.
All right, cool. Well, Guy, what have you been playing?
Awesome. Well, I finished Rayman, and I won't talk more about it, and I won't reveal how many worlds there are, but there is a good amount of content. Although my perception, of the game's length is a little bit warped by the fact that. You know, like the first world, I was really adamant about getting all the limbs. And so it was just like, start the level, die, start the level, die, start the level until I got it right. But then starting around the middle of world two, I just gave that up and just played as I went. And it was, you know, the pace was a lot more brisk. It was a little bit more fun too, because I was kind of getting tired of trying to perfect stages and failing miserably. I've also been playing Aliens Infestation on the bus. That's a DS game that came out last year, that no one bought, that Sega released with no fanfare, because they're Sega.
By WayForward?
Yes, it is by WayForward. Yeah. And, like, those guys do a pretty good job considering, I think. They're stuck a lot of times with kind of crappy licenses but like every time we've discussed this before in the podcast, but you know, like every time they deal with a DC game like Superman or something or The Flash, they usually do one of the better adaptations that you could possibly hope for a licensed game. In this case though, they made this kind of Metroid-y type game. It has you play as different marines, trying to figure out exactly what went on the Nostromo and different cool nods to the movies like that. And one of the novelties is that you have four different marines, and if you die with any one of them, they're dead. And you can find up to like 17 of them, but those guys act as your lives. And once you run out, it's just game over. So that really does add a lot to the tension of the game. And you know, like you really, really want to be careful during combat, not to try to take too much damage. The health items, the health items are really rare. And so that does add to the tension. What doesn't add to the tension is the fact that all of the enemies have these really predictable patterns. And unfortunately, like it doesn't take too long before you realize, oh, okay, like the enemies are always going to spawn at the same spot, and I can always deal with them the exact same way. And at that point, you know, like the tension is gone, the atmosphere is gone. You're just, you know, like it's very mechanical. I mean, you're going to go through the motions and you're going to get through the game, and it's just not going to be that enjoyable anymore. In fact, like I stopped playing after maybe 3 hours and I haven't picked it back up yet, and I don't really intend to.
After a while, just exploring the Nostromo isn't as interesting because all the enemies are pretty much cannon fodder for you and more like little stop signs rather than any threats. The cats, even the cat that scares you, that actually did get me the first time, it keeps popping up constantly.
Yep.
Throughout the game. Like, so if you go back to room again, it just keeps popping up.
Yeah, that's a cool nod to the movies, but then, you know, when it comes back again and again, like you really see through you peek behind the curtain, and the magic is kind of gone. Go for it.
I was just gonna say, so it's based off the Aliens movie franchise, right?
Yep, absolutely. And I'm pretty sure, like, I'm not the biggest fan, you know, like, I don't know those movies like the back of my hand, but it looks like it's pretty faithful to the whole canon of the series.
So someone who really enjoys those movies might enjoy this game more because of that? Do you think that it has that kind of value?
Yeah, it's possible. I definitely wouldn't rule it out. Except that at some point, I don't know about you, but, like, even when I like a franchise a lot, you know, that can help me overlook the flaws of a game, but after a while, like that just wears off, and then I'm left with just the game. Mm-hmm. And at that point, that's usually when I lose interest.
Okay. So, quick question, Guillaume: have you ever died near a facehugger?
No, I usually can shake them off. Okay. But I know what happens though. Like the.
Oh, okay. So.
Well, yeah, that's one interesting thing about the game. Like, apparently your guy gets, you know, like taken to the hatchery, basically, and you have to go find them and help them out. Yeah. And, you know, like, maybe you saved them in time, or maybe you didn't, but you don't know that until the chestburster actually, comes out.
The chestburster's quite cool when it happens.
All right, and one last game that I checked out was Prince of Persia Forgotten Sands on the Wii. And I don't know what took me so long before I started it. Like, it's been in my backlog forever, and only now did I start it. And all of a sudden, I remember why I like the Prince of Persia games. the animation is so good, and the movement just flows together so fluidly, you know? And it's just cool to do these, you know, cool acrobatics all the time. Even though the game's a little bit too easy, because right now I'm still doing stuff that I've done before in all of the previous Prince of Persia games. So I'm not learning anything new, but it still feels like a tutorial. And not only that, but every time there's a secret somewhere, there's always this little floating power-up that you can collect. That's going to be like right next to that secret ledge, quote unquote, or right next to, like, it's kind of the coins in the Super Mario. Like, they show you the way, except that I don't think that the coins in Super Mario ever really showed you the secrets, or at least not as blatantly as the power-ups do in Prince of Persia Forgotten Sands. So I don't know. I hope that goes away, you know, at some point, and that I can actually feel good about figuring out, okay, maybe if I go there and, you know, bam, I find a secret. The game is different from the, 360 and PS3 game of the same name. It's made specifically for Wii. It uses the pointer a lot, and in a good way, I might add. There's some waggling when you're, you know, for the combat, but other than that, like, I cannot really complain. The controls are really thought up for the Wii, and the camera is mostly automatic, but you can, you know, push it around with the pointer, and it just works really, really well.
That's a series that I always had an interest in, but I mean, I, you know, with my limited funds and everything, I tend to get the games I know I'm gonna like, or just, I don't know, just for my own taste. So I tend to unfortunately skip on games that look intriguing, but I just can't really pay the full price to get into. And then, I mean, I've talked about this before on the podcast, how then even when it goes down in price a year or two later, now, you know, my mind's on the next game that's just around the corner. And if I had a little more disposable income, I'd probably pick up these games more. But I've heard a lot of good stuff about the Prince of Persia series as a whole.
I really like Sands of Time. I never played the two drones, though. And I think I stopped somewhere in the middle of Warrior Within. So how do you felt the series evolved all the way up to Forgotten Sands?
So I really loved Sands of Time, and Fink, I know now you're a Steam fiend, so if you want to go back, like, that game is on Steam, it's probably very cheap, and definitely check it out. Like, it's probably the most impressive one in the series, like, and I don't think I'm just saying that because it was my first exposure to it. The sequel was disgusting, and I stopped playing it pretty quickly. Two Thrones was okay, but it still had this kind of edgy vibe, like that forced kind of attitude that I didn't like. Like, I don't like it in Sonic, I don't like it in Jack 2, and I really didn't like it in Prince of Persia. I did play the 2008 Prince of Persia game, the one that was all cel-shaded for the HD consoles, and that game was just terribly, terribly flawed. Like, it got high marks from every review sites, but then you would listen to their podcasts and none of them would seem to really like it. It was really strange, but I think the main flaw was that you could basically choose which level you could do in any order, but unlike a Mega Man game, there was no optimal order. And that meant that they were all as easy as the first stage in pretty much any game is. I would say that the Forgotten Sands is the most enjoyable one since the first game. And I definitely, like, start with Forgotten Sands or Sands of Time if you can, and have a good time.
Well, then I guess I'll move on, and I'll talk about what I've been playing lately. Really quick, I think I should mention this. I've been playing VVVVVV. I think I had enough V's in there. I got it in the Humble Pack 4, as well as the other game that I'll be talking about in a second. But it was really short, and I know it's coming out in the eShop, I think, this week. And it's really fun, and it's really... I mean, the graphics at first were, like, kind of making me a little weary, but, oh, it's addictive, it's really challenging, the music is great, but it's not worth $7 or $8, I think. It's going to be on the eShop. Definitely go do the Humble Pack if they're still doing it now, or you can, I think, still get it for, like, $1 something or something like that on the PC or Mac. So maybe you might want to look there. And honestly, I feel like that's the kind of game where I want the bigger screen because, you know, deaths can happen so easily, just pixel perfect precision you need. So playing on my Mac with my keyboard, actually, I found was really, really useful. And I can't imagine playing on my little 3DS.
I don't know. Like, Rebanak on the site has been tweeting about how he's recently played the copy that he already had on his computer.
Yeah.
And he finished it. He loved it. And still... he said, oh, I can't wait to play it again on, you know, on the 3DS.
Yeah, he and I had a little tweet conversation about that. And I don't know, I forget exactly how he ended up, if he ended up agreeing with me or not. I think he felt it was still worth it to pay that much money, but I think he understood my points. But, I mean, it's a great game, so no matter what, you should be playing it. And some people might want it on the go, because it is a game, there's tons of checkpoints everywhere, so it's one of those games that you could just, kind of in theory, just, you know, play for 2 seconds and flip your screen down, sleep mode it, and then move on, and then, oh, I have a few seconds now and you can try that area again.
Well, you said that it's not worth its price on the eShop. Like, are you saying that just because you've played the, like, what about someone who really doesn't want to play on the PC? Like, would you say, no, don't buy this game, it's not worth the price?
I'll say buy it, but don't blame me if you're a little bummed that it's not as long or as lengthy as you might want. There's not that much content in it. But I think the eShop one might have a few extra stuff in it. I don't know if it's enough to warrant the perhaps like 400% or whatever the percentage is that you can get it elsewhere. But it's a great game. I think everyone should play it. anyone who likes something unique and platformers, because it's a platformer like you never really expect, and it uses a gravity mechanism in a really neat way that can be both a pain in the ass and very gratifying.
Is there going to be any difference in the eShop version aside from being portable?
I don't remember, really. I haven't done too much research into that, but I swear I heard something about there being like some bonus levels or bonus content, bonus areas, I guess. It's kind of all one big level. It's kind of like Link's Awakening, where you open up little chunks of the map as you go. Each person's going to be different as far as if they think that those couple of levels are worth the perhaps $6 extra you'd be paying than you need to, you know?
Well, but again, Rebinax seems to be ready to play it again, so like, sure. Do you think that it would have a lot of replayability value?
Well, yeah, there's like 20 things to collect in there, and I've gone back already and done it, and I just played the game, so maybe my opinion skew, but the game's been out for like over a year now, or almost a year, so people who might have bought it right away might enjoy having it again, because this is the kind of game where, especially if you haven't played it for a little bit, you're going to need to rebuild that skill, so it's going to feel kind of fresh again later on, if you were to replay it. Because it is all about timing, so you're going to lose your muscle memory of that particular set of rooms, and then, you know, when you go back, you'll have to develop it all again, which is the fun. Which kind of segues into the other game that's all about pixel-perfect precision, which is Super Meat Boy. And that, unfortunately, has never been on a Nintendo console. It was supposed to be on a WiiWare, but I guess size limitations prevented it from being so. I played the demo of this on XBLA a long time ago. But I got it in the Humble Pack, and that paired with Darwin Remote, I guess it's called, is like a little program for the Mac that allows my Wiimote to connect to it. And, it's ridiculously addicting now. I have the control that I want. I wouldn't be able to play that with a keyboard. It would just mess me up. But it's just really fun. There's tons of levels. I think I'm in the final world, but each world has like a dark world to it that... you unlock if you can get the best times for the original levels. But there's also warp zones. There's a lot of bandages to collect, which are really tricky, most of them, to get. And as you collect those, you unlock characters, and those have different functions. Like Commander Video from Bit Trip Runner is a secret character in the game, and he's got a little floating mechanism. And there's a lot of replayability in that alone. You can try to best your time.
Come on, V. He's in it too, I think.
Oh, is he? Oh, the guy.
Spoiler.
The guy you're saying. Oh, no, I think he is, yeah. I haven't unlocked him yet. But no big deal. For me, anyway. But yeah, I mean, there's like 12 characters total, and 11 of them are unlockable, so.
Well, I've played like a year ago, back when it came out. I played a little of the game, and I just stopped. There's something really unappealing about the look to me. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, like people say graphics don't matter. I would say that art style matters, and the ugly art style that they went with is really not compatible with my taste. I don't know. Like I don't think I was not enjoying myself when I played it, but I'm not thinking about the game when I'm done playing it, and so that's why I still haven't come back to it.
It's definitely not, you know, Nintendo pretty, you know, as far as like colorful and everything. It's got a very grunge look to it, saw blades and just dirt or sawdust and stuff like that, but
Going to be looking at a lot of saw blades when you play that game.
Yeah, saw blades, and I guess it is blood. You are kind of playing a skinless boy, I guess is what I was explained to. Or I thought it was a clump of meat with legs, but I guess it's actually like a skinless boy. And, but I mean, like we were talking about in the thread, I mean, he could be green, he could be Booger Man, or not Booger Man, but Booger Boy or something. And it would be the same premise. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess the art style is hit or miss with some people. I don't mind it so much because I am having so much fun with the levels. I've been playing Metroid Fusion on the Ambassador games that I got, and that is my second 2D Metroid. I first had played the Primes, then Super Metroid, then Other M, and then I got this, and I am bummed that I didn't play this when it first came out. Like, I wasn't even really aware of this game when it first came out, but it's a lot of fun, and it's really challenging.
Well, I can understand not being aware that, you know, of the game when it came out, because it came out, what, the same week as Metroid Prime?
I think
it came out the same day.
Are you kidding me, really?
Wow. I picked them both, yep. I picked them both up on the same day when they were first released. Same day as the first Metroid Prime.
Oh, that explains it. Yeah, that was the same day that I got into Metroid as a whole, but I was so engrossed in the 3D that I didn't even think, oh, is there one for the Game Boy Advance? No.
Yeah, and you were, like, new to the series, but for us, like, it was basically, oh, okay, Nintendo was apologizing for ignoring the series for 8 years.
Yeah.
By giving us two games at the same time.
Shoot. Well, I mean, they were both good games, so that's pretty nice of them, you know?
Yeah, it was a good day for Metroid fans.
So then you guys agree that it's a pretty solid title.
I mean, I like Metroid Fusion a lot. It's, I don't know if it's one of my absolute favorites of the series, but I've definitely played through it. Shoot, probably 7-8 times by now.
Dang.
I like 2D Metroid a lot, and Metroid Fusion, it's you know, I have a few issues with it, mainly regarding the kind of the linearity, but I think in some ways that kind of works in its advantage. It kind of gives it its own sort of horror feel at times, which I think is really neat.
What? And especially with you being stalked a little bit in the game, which was kind of a neat
thing. SAX. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of that is pretty freaky stuff.
And when you encounter him, you shit a brick.
To inject something into that, the linear aspect also brings along some cool scenarios, like when the power outage happens.
Right.
Like, that's harder to do in, say, an open world game, like more open world game like Super Metroid or Metroid Prime. Whereas when you make it more linear, you can throw in cool scenarios like that.
Right. And it's like really a section early on, I think when you first go to Sector 3, which is the hot one, and it's you know, it's about to melt down, you gotta go turn it off. Stuff like that is it kind of gives the game some of its big memorable moments. Mm-hmm. And I've actually it's possible to do a 1% run in the game, which is ridiculously challenging, but it's kind of fun if you're crazy and want to try it.
Personally, like, I think the game gets a lot of flack for being too linear and all that. Like, perhaps not enough, like, Super Metroid, which is the last game that we had before this game came out, and it just kind of revolutionized gaming for a lot of us, for a lot of Metroid fans. So it gets compared to that game, and not favorably usually. But I think that if you take it a little bit more as an action game, it's really, really solid. And the enemies deal a lot of damage. The health pickups don't restore your health quite enough. Like, if you get hit once and then you get a health pickup, you're not going to be back up to 100%. So you have to play more carefully than you would in Super Metroid, I think. And the range of movements that Samus has and the weapons and everything, like, you have to be a lot more careful, and I think it just works.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. The health items are like blobs of energy that actually can fuel enemies, which is kind of neat. But yeah, like, you'll get mostly 10 point pickups, but the one hit from an enemy will do like 60. So you might have to, like, I mean, one problem I did have in a few sections, like two of them, was that I'd have to come back and kind of grind just to get my health back up for a save point before a boss or something, but that doesn't happen too often.
And that's a Metroid staple, basically.
True. So,
it does have those big eye doors that that drop the red SAX. Yeah. I mean, not SAX, the red X thing that fills up a bunch of your life and missiles. And
those are traditionally in front of big baddies. So yeah, they do take care of you mostly like that. But they only fill up like 5 energy tanks. So later in the game, that becomes less or more of a hassle because that doesn't necessarily fill you all the way up. But a couple quick points, and then we'll move on from all this. I just want to say that with the linearity, I don't mind it so much, and I don't think the backtracking is even that much of a pain, because you're always going to something important, which is kind of nice. I was going to mention really quick, with the movement you were talking about, this is specifically for the 3DS Ambassador titles, that I use the slide pad, and it works pretty well. However, for the, what is it, not the screw attack, but like just the space jump, or the when you can kind of climb higher and higher, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That gets messed up a lot, because your thumb naturally will kind of curve up when you move over, and when you hit up, that breaks your thing. So I have to switch over to the D-pad just to go left and right and not press up at all. But otherwise, it controls really well with the slide pad, and with the L and R buttons and everything. I really feel like I'm kicking ass and taking names, and there's not much issue. It's a really fun game, and I feel like it's one of the best that we were given, and I feel really happy to be an ambassador almost for that game alone. right, guys. Instead of the what do you think section that we've been doing lately, we're going to just talk about some game of the year thoughts. I don't know if we even have that many. I'm not really good at choosing game of the year type stuff. I don't typically narrow it down to one thing very often, but I know that that's not the case with some of you guys. So what do you think about the game of the year for 2011?
Should we start talking about various game of the year candidates?
Well, I mean, there's some obvious ones like, you know, Mario 3D Land, Zelda Skyward Sword. you can tell I'm a bit lame.
Like the year was pretty backloaded. Is that
Pushmo?
Yeah. Well, Pushmo. Is that
the right? Yeah, Pushmo. Yeah, that's a candidate, I'd say.
We only complained about it for like 10 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pushmo is definitely good. All right. So, what did you guys think of Mario 3D Land?
I loved
it. It's a good game.
Yeah, I mean, it was good.
I'm already done with it.
It gave me an orgasm.
It was good. It gave him an orgasm, but is it game of the year?
Haven't played it yet. 2 weeks old 3DS here. Well, that's less than 2 weeks old.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think it's one of the clear contenders, not out of pure Nintendo bias, but it's just a really quality game. If it was released by any other company, you'd have to, you know, give them props for that.
Mario 3D Land kind of took me by surprise. I think I underestimated it a little bit. I was a little worried it would basically be like New Super Mario Brothers with a little more depth. Like New Super Mario Brothers meets, you know, the Paper Mario perspective or Luigi's Mansion perspective. You know, and that didn't really excite me that much. But when I played the game, it basically takes, you know, what's best about 2D Mario and mixes it in with a little bit of the creativity of that 3D Mario allows, like with the Galaxy games. Mm-hmm. And came up with something that's really good, like a really excellent portable game especially. I'd say it's by far the best portable Mario game. And maybe not my favorite game of the year, but definitely a close number two.
Yeah, like Super Mario 3D Land is definitely a really, really well-made game. And as Matt said, like, it's definitely the best Mario handheld Mario game that's ever been made. And it would be kind of easy, I think, to give it a game of the year, but the contrarian in me wants to perhaps give it to an underdog. And on my list, I also have Kirby Returns to Dreamland, Kirby Mass Attack, and actually Ghost Trick. And
Is that Kirby Ghost Trick?
No, it's not Kirby Ghost Trick. Yeah, I did become kind of a Kirby whore this year, but
I approve.
It's not really my fault because Nintendo has been whoring Kirby up, you know, in 2011. and we've gotten like Dream Land and the eShop. We've gotten a 3D remake of the Kirby's Adventure on the eShop. Yep. Gotten a DS and a Wii Kirby game. So you'd think that I'd be sick of the little guy by now, but he's so cute and pink and round, and the games are actually really, really good. I've already talked at length about each of these games, but if you force me to pick my favorite child, if you force me to pick my favorite child, I think it has to go to Mass Attack. And I'm actually kind of surprised by my own choice. But when I think back about that game, about all the stuff that it did right, all the novel ways that it used touchscreens, the touchscreen, even though like the DS has been around for 6 years now, that's quite an achievement. And the difficulty curve was always just right. It's got some flaws, like, don't get me wrong, like the checkpoint system, which doesn't exist, should really, something should have been done about that, and trying to get medals, gold medals for, you know, going through.
For not getting hit.
Yeah, that can be really, really frustrating, and I think I stopped playing, I stopped trying to do that around the third world, and the fact is, I kind of want to go back and pick it up again. So, yeah, I have to give it up to Kirby Mass Attack. Ghost Trick was fantastic. If you want to hear about that game, listen to episode 16. Pluto and I gush about, and Zero, actually, we had all played it, and we all absolutely loved it. The story might seem silly initially, and you're going to be like rolling your eyes a whole lot. But then towards the end, you're going to realize, holy crap, this made a whole lot more sense than it had any right to. And your jaw is just going to drop to the floor, I think.
It was a very fun and engaging game. It's nice to see a Phoenix Wright team do something aside from Phoenix Wright after like four straight games.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's unfortunate, though, that it didn't sell very well, because I really would like to see a sequel to it. Without
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say this, but I haven't finished Ghost Trick yet. I'm currently in the middle of it. I don't remember exactly where. I need to finish it, because I know what that team is capable of, especially in terms of storyline twists and things like that.
Well, let me make you feel better by saying I've not even played it, so now you are not the lamest person on the podcast, as far as Ghost Trick is concerned.
It's all. Did you buy it at least?
I know. This is actually the first time I've heard of it.
It's your fault we're not getting a sequel to it.
It's my fault. I take full responsibility. You can send your Operation Ghost sequel letters to me, and I'll get my ass on that. Let me go back to Kirby really quick, just to make it definitive, even though I think I've asked Guy this before. The 3D classic Kirby's Adventure, is it worth me buying? Because if it is, I will buy it tonight.
I would ask Matt to feel that one. Okay. What's the guy with a 3DS and a Wii?
And I haven't played Kirby that much in my lifetime, so I'm looking to like be swayed.
Kirby's Adventure is sort of the definitive early Kirby game. It's the second Kirby game that came out, and it's the first one that allows you to copy powers. Okay. It's for the NES, and at the time it was released, which was like 93, it was a huge game for the NES, and it was really something that was pretty amazing for the time because of how much variety you can get out of that copy ability thing. The Ambassador Program you mentioned was an amazing mirror, and that's actually one that I haven't really put much time into, but it's sort of strangely confusing to me. It doesn't feel very user-friendly to me, and I don't find it all that compelling at the moment.
I get lost because there's so many mirrors to do, and I don't feel like I'm ever going towards a goal.
Mirror also is that the map system does, like, it tries to go for like unified world concept, but like the paths don't really connect the way you think they do.
Oh, not at all.
And it gets really confusing, especially when you came in. The map doesn't help either. So you start wandering around, and you start winding up in areas you don't want to go to.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a little bit of an oddball.
Yeah.
So don't. I was just going to say, so I shouldn't use it as a judging point for Kirby as a whole.
No. Kirby is usually, like, Kirby's Adventure is a stage-driven game. It's very, I'd compare it to, like, Mario 3. You have worlds, you have levels within the worlds, and you can, there's little secrets within the levels, but it's definitely linear and action-driven and well-designed. I give it a recommendation, but my absolute favorite Kirby game is Superstar for the Super Nintendo or the Wii's Virtual Console, mm-hmm. which is magnificent.
Okay, so preventing this derail anymore, any other thoughts? I mean, Matt, you didn't really mention what you think is your game of the year.
Oh, right. Yeah, for me, it was kind of between several games. The Kirby games, both of them I really liked. Pushmo actually is a pretty late contender. Not quite up there with the best of them. Rayman's very solid. And I'm definitely enjoying Mario Kart as well, but it doesn't really add very much new besides a few minor things. I'm going to have to be very boring and say that my game of the year, at least at the moment, is The Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword. What do you guys think of Zelda?
I liked it. I mean, I've been pretty outwardly, positive about the game, as most people have been. But as far as the games that came out for Wii this year, absolutely, it could be, a game of the year.
Admittedly, I really only own, in terms of current generation consoles, the Wii and 3DS and the DS, so that's the only pool I get to pick from. But Skyward Sword, I had a few problems with it, and I can talk about it more in the next segment, which is more about Zelda. But I think ultimately it really captured a lot of what I like about Zelda and brought in some new stuff that I thought were good additions to the series. And it got me emotionally invested in several spots, which is really, I can't say that about a lot of Zelda games or a lot of games in general. The last Zelda game that I felt had a really good emotional core to it was Wind Waker. And that was kind of a while ago. I mean, think about that, as 8 years ago. Before that, you know, like it seemed Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, and Wind Waker all had this kind of gripping emotional core, and Skyward Sword kind of brought some of that back. And for the most part, I think it was done really well. There was a moment pretty late in the game, not exactly at the end, but fairly late, that I thought was really well written and honestly very sweet. So that was one of the many things that I liked about the game. And yeah, it definitely had some issues. I mean, you had that whole long Fi introduction stuff, but I mean, I can kind of look past those. It's probably not in my top five Zeldas, but I mean, coming from me, that's still pretty high praise, because I put about six or seven Zeldas in my top 20 games. So anyway, Skyward Sword, not the greatest Zelda, but probably the greatest game of the year for me.
I think it'll be interesting to see what next year's game of the year will be, considering we have no idea what's coming up. And
Xenoblade.
Well, there's that, but then there's the entire Wii U library.
Paper Mario,
Animal Crossing. So maybe this year is a little boring, but it'll be interesting to see next year.
Metroid, it's its 25th anniversary, and there's really not much talked about for its 25th anniversary, unlike, say, Mario and Zelda. I don't think there is even a Metroid game coming out. I mean, Metroid 2 got released on the eShop, and that's basically it.
I was going to point that out, yeah.
Infusion was an ambassador title, but...
Oh, okay. I stand correct on that one, then. So just wanted to give a little do, kind of talk a little bit about its history, and then maybe speculate kind of where the series is going.
Now, really quick, let me just, sorry to cut you off, but is it the 25th anniversary for Japan or America or both? I mean, I'm not sure.
I think it's Japan. I believe it's Japan.
Well, now,
1986.
So maybe, do you think that maybe they're just going to hold it off for next year when it's the American 25th anniversary? Or do you think it's just they just didn't care?
I think they just don't care. But I could stand corrected on that, because Metroid is bigger in the U.S. than it is in Japan.
Right.
Mm. So it's possible they might make a bigger deal of it.
Blasters crossed.
Okay. No, I just looked it up. I just cheated. August 1986 in U.S.
Oh, so...
Oh, in the U.S. Wow.
So no, never mind. There is no 25th anniversary celebration for Pearl Samus.
Son of a bitch. Okay.
Yeah. That is sad.
Okay, so going forward, or back to the past, their series was originally created by two people. It's Makoto Kano and Hiroji Kiyotaki, who are both not even involved in the series anymore.
Hmm.
Makoto Kano kind of created the whole concept. It was influenced by Aliens, the Alien movies, in the past, and Hiroji Kiyotaki did the artwork for the original series. Hiroji Kiyotaki, I believe, is also the artist for Wario, if I'm correct on that one. And also back then, Yoshio Sakamoto, who basically took over for a series, he was the original director for the series.
For the first game, right?
For the first game. And was pretty much involved in every game since, except for the Prime games, where his involvement is very minimal. And Metroid 2, where he was not involved at all. And one of the big things with the first Metroid, of course, is it was an open world game. One of the little standout points of it was when you first enter the game, you want to get the morpho by going left, where most games at the time you move left to right to kind of put a little emphasis without making you go through a whole long tutorial. Just for your own sake.
That's crazy how things have changed, you know. I love that those old Nintendo games do stuff like that. You don't even notice it, but it's pretty genius when you think about it. You know, you'll start off going right and realize, wait a minute, that can't be right, and then you'll learn, oh, okay, so this is about exploration. They do something similar with the Mario Mushroom, like the very first mushroom, how it hits a pipe and, you know, has to run into Mario. So
yeah.
Sorry,
yeah, yeah, like not only that, but like the whole like going left instead of right might not seem like a big deal to us, but I imagine that back then most people had only maybe played Mario, and in that game they wouldn't even let you go back to where you had been.
Right, the screen just so, locks.
It's a whole new like freedom that you have.
Suddenly. Also, absolutely. Back then, when you first went left, when you got the Morph Ball, you were stuck unless you actually used the Morph Ball. So, without any words, they just kind of taught you to explore and also how to use the Morph Ball, which was a very novel thing at the time, to kind of get into tight corridors and became a really big deal in terms of exploration further in the game. It also made a great use of the of both vertical and vertical corridors also, which was not seen as much during those times.
I'm not sure if they made like a great use of them though, because they're so confusing. They yeah. always look the same, and I get lost easily in that game. Although, yeah, back when we were kids, like if I had played the game when I was 8 and that was the only game that I had, I would probably have memorized them by now. It's a little bit harder today as an adult, That's probably why a lot of people say that Metroid is a little bit too old for them to get into, and they prefer Super Metroid with its helpful map and also more distinguishable areas.
Yeah, visually. Yeah.
I've got that problem.
I remember when I played Metroid for the first time, I was completely lost. This exploration concept was very hard for me to grasp, and I didn't even keep a map around, so I just kept wandering and without aimlessly kind of figuring out where to go. I'm like, where am I? What am I doing? Am I even making any progress? Yeah, that was me at like 5 years old or something. how far I've come. But yeah, the series also kind of had a darker tone compared to Nintendo's other series at the time. And it kind of jump-started a nice series. It was created also around the same time as Kid Icarus, which also used a lot of vertical corridors, especially at the beginning of the game in the underworld.
Yeah, is that made by the same team, or am I
same team? All confused? I think there's a little crossover of staff. Think they did have Tip Tanaka doing the music for both. I think Sakamoto was also involved in Kid Icarus, but I'm not sure to what extent. Yes.
Oh, sorry, I was about to ask about Gunpei Yokoi.
He was the producer for all the games. He was kind of the main guy behind R&D1, so he was producer for primarily most of the games until his unfortunate departure and subsequent death. But I don't, as far as game design goes, I've never really read anything where he had a huge involvement in the actual design of the games. As far as I know, the concept was created by Makoto Kano and Hiroji Kiyotake, and then Sakamoto kind of took over in the director's role. Metroid 2 actually did not have Sakamoto's involvement. That was co-directed. I don't recall the other name of the other director, but Kiyotake was the director for Metroid 2. Kano was also on the team at the time.
The Metroid 2 was actually my introduction to Metroid. I had played maybe like 10 minutes of the NES game, and for some, like the commercial, look up the commercial for Metroid 2 on YouTube. Maybe it doesn't look like much now, but back when I was a kid, it was extremely intriguing. And like the pixels turned into a face telling you basically go buy the game. and at some point, like the eyes started glowing red. And in my mind, I don't think I was dumb enough to actually think that, but it was just like, oh wow, color in a Game Boy game or something. I don't know, like there was something special about like an all Spanish and black commercial, and all of a sudden for a Game Boy game, and you know, I don't know, it was kind of shocking. But enough about the commercial. the game, like Wei, you mentioned how the original game confused your 5-year-old mind. Metroid 2 definitely did that to my 11-year-old mind, because sometimes you could shoot walls and blocks would disappear and that created corridors. Sometimes you would just like walk through walls, and that confused the hell out of me. There's not really any rhyme or reason to what works and what doesn't. it's a maze, definitely, in the purest sense of the word, with false walls and traps and everything, even though the game confused the heck out of me, and even though I probably spent more time playing, what was it? I think I got Final Fantasy Legend 2 at the same time. The game made enough of an impression that Super Metroid was the first game that I got once I had saved up enough cash for a Super NES.
Yeah, I had grown up with the original Metroid, and I remember liking it a whole lot, and I still like it a lot. It's pretty obtuse, but I think Metroid 2 did a pretty good job of well, first of all, it's the first one with the whole visible various suit, like the modern design of Samus.
It kind of really defined Samus's look. It was kind of more abstract than the original, but it really, that gave it a defining look. I think the lack of color kind of helped that, where they had to kind of make other things distinguish Samus more since they don't have color anymore.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Like the Game Boy's limitations made the whole trick of turning Samus's cannon, you know, changing color, it was impossible. So they actually had, okay, well, then it's going to open up so that missiles can come out. Right, and that kind of detail that, I don't know, that blew my mind back in the day.
It was also a little less confusing than the original because the game, the way it's designed is pretty much in these chunks. Like you have basically stages that are more or less self-contained, and you have to kill all the Metroids to make the lava go down so you could go down even further.
We do talk about how linear the recent Metroids have been, but Metroid 2 was also very linear as well, especially compared with the game that came before it and after it.
Yeah, to some degree, I mean, it definitely follows more of a progression in terms of this is the next area that you will always go to, and you know, you can't really sequence break. But within those areas, it can get pretty confusing still. There's still several corridors to take within those individual stages.
It also kind of also threw in, kind of evolved the storyline for Metroid, where the first one was kind of more like, okay, you're going to attack aliens, and now this time it's you're going to hunt species, and they really pushed that there's more a lot more of the ending when you first find the baby.
Yeah.
Which also now leads us to Super Metroid, where Sakamoto came back as director, and they start developing it for the Super Nintendo. And a little trivia here, Intelligent Systems, who we mentioned previously, they actually got involved in Super Metroid's development because R&D1, being primarily a Game Boy developer at the time, were very unfamiliar with the Super Nintendo hardware, so Intelligent Systems helped them out with the programming. I think Sakamoto might be kind of the key in the non-linear, because Metroid 2 did not have his involvement, and that turned out very linear, but Sakamoto was involved in 1 and Super, and those really pushed the exploration aspects, and I think he's kind of like, probably was the key for how the series evolved into what it is now, a more non-linear aspect. This was also the last Metroid game that Makoto Kano worked on. Since then, he was kind of more producer on various other games, and I think he stepped down, I forgot when. But that Super Metroid was the last Metroid game he got involved in. And he was the concept director, and I think that's where the series kind of went away from more the subtle aspects of it. I'm not sure if you guys would agree with me.
That was the last Gunpo Yokoi game, too. I mean, Gunpo Yokoi, Metroid game.
It was also, and it was also Kano's last Metroid game, although he did not pass away, he just moved on to other things. But Makoto Kano was the original concept designer for the series, and maybe his intention was more like a subtle alien-ish feel. Ever since then, Sakamoto kind of really was the one pushing the storyline, and he has mentioned that he wanted Samus to show more a more feminine side of Samus. He was also kind of like oversaw the Metroid manga. I'm not sure if you guys have ever seen that one. And his first game after Super was Metroid Fusion, which put in a lot more storyline aspects into the series.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure if I have a stance per se on that aspect of the Metroid series, since the only non-story-driven Metroid I've played is Super Metroid, but I do want to say that I downloaded Super Metroid on the Virtual Console right when it came out, which was right before
Corruption, right?
Yeah, before Corruption came out, a week beforehand. And it blew my mind. Like, that was 2011, so that was 4 years ago now. So I was 22, and I was just, it was, it was amazing how an old game could not only surprise me in the fact, like, why haven't I played this yet? But, I mean, for someone who had been playing games for 18 years at that point, it blew my mind incredibly. Like, it's such a well-done game. And I see why people continue to go back to that as a frame of reference instead of the originals, or as far as Gunpei as a director and everything like that. That is just his...
Producer.
Or producer, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So I just want to say before you move on in terms of titles and everything, that as someone who had my first experience with that game just not too long ago, it's just it's mind-blowing. And that's why... and. That's part of the reason I enjoy Fusion, I think, is because Super Metroid primed me for that, and I definitely find myself comparing it to Super Metroid quite a bit. Oh,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
And yeah, also, Super Metroid is definitely one of my favorites, too. I mean, my favorite of the Metroid series, and definitely one of my all-time favorites.
It kind of really set the template for how the non-linear games go, and basically create the whole Metroidvania thing, which Castlevania, of course, followed later, and then created a lot of other games that were inspired by it, including Shadow Complex and various others. And it was, and one thing about Super was that even though it didn't have that narrow focus, it did a lot with the atmosphere and kind of foreboding, like the memorable space station scene with Ridley and the baby, and when Samus first lands. Yeah, no jokes about Outer Rim yet. And then, of course, going onto planet and seeing the whole destroyed pirate base before things start going
Yeah,
crazy.
I love how it tells the story without using any words at all.
But Metroid 2 also did the same thing, although to a lesser degree. With the baby at the ending, but also throughout the game where you hear little noises, and then you go and you see like the Metroid husk just laying there, and you keep going on, and you find the evolved Metroid. So it's been doing this for a while, although it just pushed the envelope of Super.
Mm-hmm.
And now to move on, of course, then Metroid took a long hiatus. Retro Studios eventually took over. Retro Studios and R&D1 both went and developed their own games, both released on the same day, as we previously mentioned. Metroid Prime had its very dramatic little developments. Retro Studios originally developed four games. Miyamoto came, did not like any of the four games, and then basically suggested, why don't they do Metroid, based on a science fiction game they were doing. And somehow, despite all the drama and the doom and gloom and everyone going, well, at least we have Fusion coming, it turned out amazing. Blue and Mine was very faithful to the franchise in the non-linearity and a lot of the atmosphere of it.
Yeah, we hadn't really seen anything like that before. Like, people before it released thought that they were making it a first-person shooter, and that usually means like a linear experience, and like, we know what those games entail. But then we actually played it and we realized, oh wait, it's basically like Super Metroid, but in 3D. And I am being Samus, and I am inside the suit. And that was an incredible feeling.
Yeah, it's really hard to picture before you actually play it. You know, how can this possibly work? And then somehow it all does. Sorry.
And they also kind of give a little homage to Space Station, where you go into Space Station, you see all a derelict Space Station, a bunch of injured pirates. And if you scan them, it tells you like how they're hurt and stuff. And some people don't like scanning, but I thought it really added to atmosphere in the first one. I was okay with it in later games, but I felt it really matched the isolation feel and going into the ruins after a lot of stuff has already happened afterwards.
It's kind of a nice thing, too, because, you know, if you have everything play out in cutscenes, then you're going to have people who aren't going to be happy about that, considering they want to get to their game, and then you're going to have people who want to know more about the backstory because they just happen to care about that more. So this was a way of providing an optional story explanation. And it was kind of fun to discover things in little pieces and piece things together yourself because, you know, they're going to tell you this at the beginning of the game because this console has this information. But when you finally get into, like, the pirate stronghold, you're going to get some more information. And actually, I think you get perspectives from the pirates as opposed to, you know, the good guys. So it's kind of like... It's just really fun to do that, and And that's how you solve a lot of puzzles too, by scanning your area and kind of analyzing things. But that's exactly what Samus does. And we just never could experience that on the 2D games like you could before, you know? What are you going to do? Click on a pixel and then have it say nothing here or such and such, you know? I mean, it would be less engaging, but they managed to really bring you in, like that visor and just the way that the HUD looks is another great example of how they really made you, you know, the bounty hunter of the universe.
Honestly, since Prime, they really kind of went more and more linear with the Prime series. Definitely more so. And definitely the world did not feel as connected as the original Prime was. And of course, after that, we got Zero Mission from R&D1 and later Under M in conjunction with Team Ninja. Of course, Metroid Prime 2 and 3 as well. And now we can go into a little... And also Metroid Prime Hunters from NSD. So we can
that one doesn't count.
Okay, so that one doesn't count. Strike that from the record. So we're moving on. We can talk about a little bit about future. Is what's going to happen to Metroid's future now? Obviously, most just about pretty much everyone who worked on the original Prime left. Designers Mark Pacini, who was lead designer, Todd Keller, the art director, Mike Wicken, who actually recently left after working on Donkey Kong Country Returns. Who was a senior designer, and I think he got promoted after the other people left. He also left recently. So, do you think Retro will be continue to be involved in the series?
I hope so. I mean, I'm torn because I do think that they are a company that can expand beyond the Metroid series, as they've proven already. And I'd love to see them do all sorts of great things. But I mean, they still do my favorite Metroids. I love the Prime trilogy. I think it's just incredible, and so I would love to see more of that 3D first-person adventure gaming. And I don't know if they're bigger now, maybe they could handle multiple projects like that, but I'd like to see them do that. And I mean, we don't know, maybe they are doing something like that for the Wii U, but...
It's possible.
It's really hard to guess where Nintendo's going to take the series now into the future because of the recent, I guess, less than stellar sales of... the Prime sequels and Other M. I'm not sure if Nintendo is I'm not sure if it feels like they're putting that much faith in the Metroid at this point, which is a little sad. And I think it, you know, it ties in, of course, with the whole not really giving it its due credit for the 25th anniversary. So it's kind of hard to predict, I think.
And also, I think Sakamoto still has a story to tell. He definitely has. He's definitely been more narrative focused. You can tell when he basically took the reins of the series with Fusion and Zero Mission and Other M. He wants to tell a lot more story and focus on the character of Samus more. And he definitely has a direction he's going on with it based on the ending to Fusion. And of course, the heavily rumored Dread, which basically was confirmed later on by himself, by the man himself. So he definitely wants to continue to work on the series, but when he will be able to and for what system, who knows at this point?
Do you guys think we're going to... I mean, well, you kind of just asked what system, but do you think we're going to see a 2D handheld Metroid before a 3D, or at least before a console's Metroid, or no?
Well, Sakamoto did confirm that he was working on Metroid Dread for the handhelds, but then he wanted to do something more, and he got greenlit to work on the Wii game, and they basically introduced him to Team Ninja to work on it, since his team was not familiar with the home consoles. So depends on what he feels like. He wants to go back to that, continue finishing up the handheld game, or he might want to do a console again. But yeah, if he does want to do console again, Nintendo has to greenlit that again. His team's not up for a console development.
It all depends, really, if Nintendo will allow him to do the games that he wants to make or not, because after Other M, there's quite a big chance that he's not going to have that freedom. Personally, I think that Metroid is probably going to take a break, is going to be on a hiatus until Nintendo figures out how to bring it back. But just for fun, I think if we want to know where the story is going to go, we just have to wait until the Ridley Scott movie, what is it, Prometheus? comes out, yes. the Alien sequel, or prequel, sorry, the Alien prequel. And we just have to go watch that, and then a couple of years later, maybe we're going to have like an almost exact copy in the form of a new Metroid game.
Yeah, we already saw how the maternity angle influenced the Metroid series.
And like, yeah. You watch Like, you watch the first Alien, and there's, like, really just one creature, and in Metroid, you just see the Metroid towards the end. Aliens, like, they kind of go in an Aliens killing spree, and Metroid 2, you commit genocide, basically.
Queen.
I've never noticed these connections.
In Fusion, Samus gets like Metroid DNA in her, and what happens in that terrible, terrible movie, Aliens Resurrection?
Yes. Yeah.
So, Fusion has a lot to do with the first Alien, now that I think about it. With the whole SAX and the derelict ship and everything?
Oh, yeah, probably. That's, but yeah. I'm more thinking about what they did to Ripley? Yeah, Ripley. Ripley. And to Samus and Metroid Fusion and Aliens Resurrection. But yeah, we'll see, I guess.
And then, of course, taking in the Metroids as little experimentation weapons, just like how they want to take the aliens into custody. Mm. But Samus is all against that, just as Ripley was.
Oh yeah, obviously, yeah.
I'm a longtime Zelda fan, just a little bit of backstory before I dive in. I first played the original Zelda like way back around the time it came out, and I loved it. And it doesn't have, you know, the biggest set of fans these days, but a lot of people still really like it. It's still one of my favorites, and there's a lot of things I feel that game does better than any other Zelda. So I've kind of been a fan of the series ever since then. And as a fan, like many fans, I have tried to figure out the infamous Zelda timeline, how all the games connect and how, they work together, and they all have these complicated storylines. And, you know, it's always kind of cool to think about if they really do fit together in a neat way. And you have this giant storyline, this sort of epic spanning centuries, you know, millennia, all regarding this series. And I think that concept is appealing to a lot of people, which is why this
nerds.
Whole time. Yeah, we're nerds. Yeah, we love it. So Nintendo decides to, this being the 25th anniversary, they make this very nice book that I'd like to get at some point, and I hope it's translated, but I don't know if that's going to happen. This is a very large art book, in case you haven't heard, chronicling the entire series and, unfinished like designs and sketches and, you know, concept art and all sorts of cool things. And the big news, of course, with that was the reveal of the official timeline, which is something that is unprecedented in the series. And so they released the timeline, and I don't really know how to start. There's a problem with it. There's several problems with the timeline.
Well, I think not to necessarily send you where you may not want to go right now, but the biggest surprise was the tri-split timeline theory.
The tri-split timeline theory. That's right.
The leg of this timeline that nobody expected existed.
Yeah, that's kind of the crux of the timeline. Now, I think I should preface this by saying that I feel Zelda, when you talk about something like a timeline, you have to take into account the storytelling of the games and what each game is trying to achieve with its story. And I've always been a big fan of the storyline in Zelda games. I feel that In general, they're very charming, they're very simple, and they're kind of fairy tale-ish. You know, you have the boy, you know, the hero, you have the girl, the damsel, and you have the villain. And you sort of have this sort of simple but like beautiful little set, this set of three, and it kind of ties in with the whole Triforce thing, of course. And essentially, you have that basic framework, and, you know, there's every now and then you'll have something to kind of shake it up in kind of a cool way. But at its heart, it's not really a complicated story, and it really never has been. At times, you'll have a different storyline, like in Link's Awakening, for instance, you don't really involve that sort of fairy tale thing, but it's still a generally very simple story that's extremely effective. I think pretty much everyone will agree that Link's Awakening story is really well told and really well done and very emotional as well.
It's one of the most touching that I've really found personally.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of both the series and just Game Boy games especially, it's really a well-done storyline.
Going into that, it actually is interesting how for the early games anyway, with Link to the Past to Link's Awakening and Ocarina of Time to Majora's Mask, it kind of went from like an epic scale to more well-told, neat little story.
Sort of personal scale, yeah.
Like more on a more personal scale. Majora's Mask wasn't as epic as Ocarina of Time, but it kind of really got you involved with the NPCs, with all the side quests, kind of threw a little personal friendship storyline into it. So it's actually interesting how they tell like that, where when they divert from the whole, the three pieces of Triforce, the Triforce story, goes into another tale that's very engaging, and which a lot of fans would argue that are more engaging.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting how you have that parallel. And several Zelda games do involve the Triforce and the main three, key members of the Triforce. Basically, the whole good versus evil thing. And I think that's at the heart of a lot of this series. But like Wade just said, you also have these more personal, smaller stories that, might not tie right into the overall structure, but are just as effective in different ways. So basically what I'm saying here is you don't really, for me, Zelda stories are not like major RPG stories. They're not like Final Fantasy III. They're not like, Chrono Trigger or basically bigger RPG. I haven't really played a whole lot of recent RPGs, otherwise I'd be able to list more, but they don't take that approach. They generally take a smaller approach. And I feel that recently the series has kind of attempted to take that bigger approach, and it doesn't always work exactly right. So I'd have to say that Nintendo is great at emotion and often character development and often storytelling, but the core storylines have generally still remained simple at their heart. So bringing this back to the timeline, my problem with the timeline is it feels that they're trying to shoehorn all the games together, and it's just kind of impossible to do. It's why no one's been able to agree on a timeline all this time, because, Ganon explodes in Zelda 1, and he also explodes in Link to the Past. And there's just a million little things like that where it doesn't really add up. And I'm not saying the games don't connect, because Zelda 1 leads into Zelda 2. Link to the Past is before Zelda 1. Ocarina of Time is before that. And Wind Waker is after Ocarina of Time. And these games all reference each other, which is kind of neat. But after about that point, everything just gets a little too convoluted to actually work in a cohesive way. So this is why I've always really didn't like the split timeline. The split timeline, which has been confirmed, it's now three split timelines. To basically go over that real quick, basically at the end of Ocarina of Time, Kid Link, Link goes back to being a kid, and apparently the era which he's an adult in goes on without him. Okay, so apparently you have that timeline, you have the timeline when he's a kid, and each of these timelines spans off into different directions of the history of Hyrule. Various canon games are in each of these timelines, and there's even a third timeline, which is, I'm looking at this translation here, the hero of time is defeated. So that's the third timeline. If Link dies against Ganon in Ocarina of Time, it branches off into another history of Hyrule. And there's several problems I have with this idea. And the biggest one, the main one, is that Zelda, when you do something like this with time travel, it doesn't, you can't really just say, okay, the timeline splits and now everything works. You have to incorporate these something this convoluted and this sci-fi-ish. You have to incorporate it into a clever way for it to really make sense without just being a way to cram all these square pigs. Square pegs in a circular hole?
Yes.
Square pegs in circular holes. And that's kind of what it feels like they're doing. And secondly, it's a really arbitrary way to split the timeline. I mean, to fit everything in. Why would Link get killed by Ganon? Why can't he get killed by Ganon in other games? Why wouldn't that split the timeline a million other ways? And the idea of Link dying to Ganon is just, it seems very contrary to the game's, I don't know, to the series' soul, if that makes any sense. I mean, Link is supposed to kill Ganon. And I know in Wind Waker the hero doesn't appear, but he eventually kills Ganon in Wind Waker. So it seems really silly to me that they have this just this arbitrary event that never happened in the game and never is referenced of the hero getting killed by Ganon and the sages somehow still sealing up Ganon without Link. It's just, it's very strange to me. And it sounded like someone wanted to say something, so I'll stop for a moment.
Well, I don't know if I was the one who was muttering, but my thing that I was talking with Poe Squadron about this, and this is more or less justification that probably isn't really, you know, good enough. But to me, I feel like if you're going to split it anywhere like that where the hero dies, it should be Ocarina of Time, because if you're dealing with time travel, then that is an option that is created no matter what. But all the other links are not time links. You know, you do have dark world traveling and other things like that, but this is the time, you know, the hero of time. So I can understand that. I can let it go. I can let it slide, you know. But you are, what was the point I was going to make? You are correct that kind of, it's not referenced, and I kind of wish that there was more to say about that. Because that would just make it feel better, but I die in every Zelda game, like, once, you know? I mean, a lot of people do, so it doesn't make any sense right now. And then if you look at the map, or the timeline map, it explains that the Ceiling War happens right after Link is defeated. That's what happens right before Link to the Past and everything. So maybe this is the problem they had with wanting to release a timeline, is that now we're going to have all these problems, and maybe they want to make a game that takes place during the Ceiling War, which then could explain things about Ocarina of Time or the hero dying. So they still can go back and fix this, but it's just going to take time with each new game, and I think this is one of the problems, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I guess they could worry about spoiling storyline ideas that they have.
Right, because the Ceiling War is a pretty significant sounding thing, and I think it's, I know that there was some sort of war referenced. Is it the Ceiling War?
They mentioned the Imprisoning War in several of the games.
Right, that's okay, that's what I'm thinking of. And, I mean, that's not in that same timeline, but I think that we just need more time to have some more games, and then they will fill in the gaps eventually. I don't think that they want to make it confusing, but I think that this is just their kind of half-assed way of satisfying fans, which only is going to upset us. But
I think originally they never intended, really never thought about the connections. It really wasn't until more recent games where they really started trying to connect the dots. So, which makes connecting older games like A Link to the Past and the original Zeldas before that to Ocarina of Time a lot harder to do.
Right.
But now it looks like they're kind of that direction with Skyward Sword. Well, even though that really is before timeline, that they're trying to do a more connect the series better together. Wind Waker also was definitely obviously a follow up to Ocarina as well.
Skyward Sword, I thought, overall did a pretty good job of actually being a sort of origin story. It doesn't really explain everything, but it puts a lot of little hints into place to, to set up sort of future events, which I think is really neat. And there was something that kind of blew my mind. It's not a spoiler or anything, but I thought it was really cool. Someone actually had to point it out to me, but the red bird on Link's shield, you know, and his Hylian shield that you see in all the games, is of course a reference to his Crimson Loftwing. Sure. And that's why you see those bird symbols everywhere in Skyloft, and the game never spells it out for you, but you know, you can come to that conclusion of that's the origin of that symbol and why you see it in these games. You know, you see the red bird and you see the Triforce above it on the shield. It's like, oh, that's cool. Here's my problem with the whole splitting thing. It just feels so arbitrary. Like, when you make it like that, anything splits the timeline. Any decision you make in life splits a timeline. If I pick this remote up and put it down, that I just split the timeline. I am now in the universe where I picked up that remote. So why should these other timelines exist simultaneously? I mean, you have really an infinite amount of timelines if they never intersect or interact. And the Zelda series, like I was saying, that the storylines aren't strong enough to support this sort of convolution. It just feels contrary to what I like and what I want in a Zelda story. So I guess that's kind of my collection of problems with the Zelda timeline. It's a series that I feel has really good storylines, but I don't think they work well together in general.
Do you think they would have been better off if they just like kind of came out and said, like, these are all different stories, they're kind of more self-contained? Do you think that would have been better?
Well, it maybe to some degree, but the problem there is that several of the games definitely reference other games. I feel Wind Waker did a really good job of linking together several of the games. And, you know, even stuff like Majora's Mask is definitely a sequel to Ocarina. So I think it'd be best if they said not all of the stories link together perfectly, but clearly several of them do. So you can't really throw it all out the window. But
like maybe, I didn't mean all the games. Like maybe we can throw, it's like, say, the original Zelda and Zelda's Adventure are kind of their own little self-contained story,
you,
maybe.
You know, possibly. But I've even seen, you know, some pretty interesting theories regarding those. I think if anything is kind of a weak link in terms of tying the story together, it would be the Oracle games, which are pretty strange when you think about it. They don't really fit anywhere. And Minish Cap is a little bit like that, and Four Swords is a little bit like that. If you take those out, most things become pretty simple.
But is Four Swords in the new timeline or not? Was Four Swords included in the new timeline?
Yeah, Four Swords is in the Child Era, which includes Majora's Mask, Twilight Princess, and Four Swords Adventures is after that. Huh. So now there you have it.
That's the Four Swords like Hyrule Adventure. The Four
right.
Swords.
Four Swords Adventure. The original Four Swords is actually quite a bit before that. It's before Ocarina of Time, but after Minish Cap.
Yeah.
Officially, yeah. So, I mean, I appreciate Nintendo's effort in, you know, trying to link it all together, but I don't know.
Well, I don't think it makes...
The whole timeline thing bothers me.
I don't think it makes as little sense as it comes off, because if you look at, like, the history of the Earth, and, I mean, dinosaurs, right? It's been a while since they've been around, but that was a period on the Earth where that was going on, you know? And so... all these stories, and since they're different links, they're not all the same link. I mean, this stuff can happen. I mean, really, the thing that gets confusing is when you reference, like, the bad guys and how they come into play in the here or there. But, I mean, they just keep dying and being resurrected and dying and being resurrected. So, really, I mean, you can leave some leeway there, too. So, I don't really have that big of a problem with it. My biggest problem would be the hero is defeated surprise. Even though I try justifying it for you guys, but that is like the weirdest thing of it all. But I mean, if each link even was a different guy, then this all could happen. It's kind of nice that they have, I do like that the timeline has like, you know, the world's creation and the era of this and the sky era and then force era, and they just keep going down. It kind of reminds me of like the Mesozoic era.
Like the Jurassic era. Yeah.
And so they can be contained in these eras themselves, and they can just put game after game after game and fill in information here, fill in information there.
Right.
So I think that the weakest part of the timeline would be the heroes defeated thing, but the strongest would actually be these era titles, the Era of the Great Sea and the Great Voyage. Cause maybe we'll have another sequel to Phantom Hourglass that will link to the continent being discovered for Spirit Tracks or something, you know? I think it helps them organize games and think of ideas, but I can see where it also can come off so confusing and unpleasant to think about.
You know, I think I agree about that. Basically, you know, I'm looking at the timeline. I think I don't really have much of a problem with the stuff before Ocarina of Time. I think at its core, my main problem with the timeline is definitely just the idea of splitting the timeline. I've always been kind of anti-split. And I was sort of bummed out to find out that not only was that confirmed, but they got a third leg. So that's kind of the main thing. But it looks like I'm running out of time. So if anyone has anything to add.
I'll add to what you just said. I think it's kind of, even though it is kind of silly to have three splits, it is kind of nice because now we can have these games that kind of tell the tale of that link. So they can do three different directions with the same kind of character that we know and love, and they can do, and we don't have to worry about, you know, Twilight Princess referencing Wind Waker anymore. You know, they can just do what they want, and they can focus on referencing a few games to kind of make it link in that direction, link in this direction. And in a way, I think it frees them up in the manner that they want to be freed. And but it just takes some acceptance on my part.
My topic, it's a doozy. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's right.
Doozy.
Awesome. Well, I've been playing a lot of 2D platformers and a lot of, well, platformers in general, I guess. And maybe in that type of game more so than in other types of games. I'm not sure. Like, those platformers usually aren't terribly plot-driven or... You know, you don't play them for their cutscenes or their story or their set pieces, usually. It's all gameplay, gameplay, gameplay. And I was kind of wondering if challenge is a requirement for a fun platformer, but also for games in general. Because I've been playing pretty difficult platformers. I've been playing pretty easy platformers in the last few months. I've been playing platformers that were too easy and then turned finally to the right difficulty later on. Mm-hmm. For instance, like perhaps like the best example that I can give is Kirby Returns to Dream Land. I was so disengaged when I played the main quest on normal. I was kind of wondering if the level design was a little bit lazy, perhaps. I was kind of doubting that the game was perhaps even that good, and I was mostly enjoying the challenge rooms, which require you to master each ability to their fullest and to not make any mistake. And that was a very, 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 very old school challenge and definitely hard to pull off.
Once you unlock the hard mode in Kirby, everything feels just right. It's as if you can't just hurl yourself at bosses and enemies anymore. You actually have to learn the patterns. You actually have to know exactly what you're doing. You have to move right correctly. Like there's very little margin for error. When you get hit, there's consequence, and all those little things add up. Like they make the game more tense. You can't be lazy anymore. You can't just be like, oh, well, you know, it doesn't really matter if I get hit here because I'm going to survive anyway. I'm going to pick up an item that's going to give me my full health back. And there's, you know, I can play as sloppily as I want and I'm still going to progress.
Do you have to unlock that mode by beating it?
Yeah, you do. And I think that's unfortunate. That's probably one of the things that kept the, you know, why I didn't pick that game as my game of the year. I'm not sure if I said this on the podcast before, but I would recommend people to play multiplayer through the main story first, because co-op is going to make the game so much more fun. And also because you kind of want a relaxing, easy platformer when you're playing co-op most of the time, especially with people who don't play that kind of game very often. And then you can just sit down with a hard mode, with your hardcore mode on and just have a good time, you know? But yeah, like... I've got several examples that I could give, but basically that's my main point. Like, when the game allows you to play lazily, when there's no consequence, that just dulls the fun a little bit. Like, would you guys agree with that, or am I the only one?
Well, I definitely agree with that. I mean, if I'm just running through a stage where I don't really have to think, it does feels just dissatisfied. And honestly, I'm not, like, engaged. It feels like I can just really walk through the story, not have to give any effort.
Yeah, I definitely like challenging games a lot, especially platformers, because I think platformers are probably my favorite genre. But it's sort of weird because I didn't really feel too bothered by Return to Dreamland's difficulty.
But you did play co-op, right?
Well, what happened was I played I think the second world in co-op my first time through it, but the rest of the time I played by myself. Then the second time through it on the hard mode, I played through the entire game in two-player co-op. So I played sort of I had kind of a weird way of playing, I guess. But I actually enjoyed myself both times. I think I expect Kirby to be a little simpler for starters. But also, I think for me, the appeal was more in playing around with the moves and kind of just having a good time. It's kind of more of a relaxing sort of a platformer slash, I don't know, beat 'em up or action game in certain cases, depending on what moveset you have, I suppose, than a white knuckle challenge. But I also, of course, did the challenge rooms and stuff at the same time. So I guess it just didn't, that element, at least in that game, didn't bother me as much because I was still kept kind of, I guess, mentally stimulated or challenged by just the wide variety of moves. I like to experiment with those, and I don't know, it kept me entertained enough the first time through, and I definitely like the additional challenge afterwards. But
right, like you touched on something though, like discovering the moves and just enjoying yourself that way. That's definitely early on in a game, like this kind of discovery can make an easy game enjoyable, and you don't want the game to be too hard usually. Otherwise, you know, you're just trying to figure out how the game works, and you get your ass handed back to you. That's not usually very fun. So you want to be eased in, and you want to take the time to explore a little bit what you can do. But if the game takes a little bit too long to ramp up, it just gets a little bit tedious, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can see that.
I tend to see like the devil's advocate of all these. Like whenever we have podcasts, I always tend to be able to see both sides of these stories and everything. And with this particular topic, I've been thinking about like the games that I've played my entire life, and a lot of them don't necessarily give me options, at least not originally, to change the difficulty. Especially the old school NES games, you know, like Mega Man is Mega Man from the start, I believe. In some games you can unlock things, and I've been pretty complacent with just like accepting whatever a game comes at me as the developer's intent. Just like with a movie, like I don't criticize movies too much because you know what? If that's the decision they made, even if I think it's boneheaded, that's the decision that's their vision, and I can respect that. However,
You did say during the Kirby discussion, and unless you edit it out, like it's on record, you found Kirby a little bit too easy, and so you couldn't get into it.
And that's true. And with Super Meat Boy, while I'm having a lot of fun with it, on occasion, I worry it's going to be too hard for me, and it's kind of a bummer that I won't be able to. I don't think I'm going to be able to beat every level because I think some of them are just going to be out of my reach, reflexes and whatnot. So it is kind of a bummer on both spectrums when a game is too easy, whether that's the developer's intent or not, but then I can't enjoy it. And then if it's too hard, well, then I can't enjoy it either. So I feel like more, I guess, if I think about it, I'm more of an advocate for having, I guess, maybe a normal mode. Or, well, not necessarily normal mode, because if they want it to be easy, then that should be normal mode. But just a mode that they intend to, but they should well craft, you know, different difficulties in it from the start. I don't see how it's that detrimental to give options. Because it's
Warrior Land, Shake It style.
What do you mean?
Oh, yeah, with the different objectives. Like, you could go through a level in Warrior Land, Shake It pretty easily, but it's difficult to do so without, you know, getting hit, for instance.
Well, we already had this discussion, though, in like the third episode, the kind of level, like the difficulty selection. And I think the consensus was that in an action game, changing the health bar or stuff like that, how much damage that the enemies dish out was effective. But in the platformer, you can't really have these difficulty levels because what you have to change is the difficulty of the platforming itself.
Yeah. Would you consider Kirby to be a platformer or an action game? Because it does change the health.
Yeah, it is. Because you can so easily puff up and float over pits, it's kind of hard to categorize, but
yeah,
probably it's a little bit more of an action game in its DNA.
I feel like Mega Man 10, though, did that pretty well because
it paved over the pits with blocks.
Yeah,
easy mode, and then for the harder difficulty, it would change the position of enemies, and it would add enemies, and it would So it, I don't know if it, I mean, it probably did affect your health differently, but they actually made it, you know, they just did some level design changes, not in a cheap way, but in a way that would make it harder, but legitimate. Right. And I thought that was really great.
That game has the biggest gap I've ever seen between easy mode and hard mode. Easy mode is so unbelievably easy, and hard mode is so hard.
Well, yeah, I was kind of thinking, it's weird that Steven thinks that it's a good, it's a good, like, it did it well, because what I've heard from people, I still haven't played it yet, but what I've heard from people is that it feels kind of condescending when you play the easy mode. Because, like, come on, like, you pave over these pits completely. Come on, give me more credit than that.
Well,
to be fair, they do. It doesn't feel lazy. It feels like they put some effort into making sure people could get through it without a problem. But for people that have been playing Mega Man for a long time, it's definitely way too easy.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you have two modes to choose from. What would be the easy for the hardcore gamer, or normal, or then you'd have the hard, you know. I think that's what was great. Since it wasn't like normal and only easy or something like that, I don't know. That would be, since it's paired up with a pretty good hard mode, I think that it feels well-rounded. The fact that it's the widest spectrum allows, you know, people from my grandmother, if she felt inclined, down to like the most hardcore gamer I could ever meet. And they all could enjoy the game and talk about the bosses, talk about the levels, the music. They could get into it.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and I mean, they're not going to nitpick. Oh, well, I jumped over that pit, you know, you suck, you know, you needed the platform, you know. And it's not every platform either. It's not like you can't die, like in Kirby Epic Yarn, you know, you can't really die, right? So that's what was kind of a bummer for me. But in Mega Man, yeah, you can die, there is still risk. The enemies still definitely hurt you, and there's just a couple less than the, you know, the normal, and the pits are a little less plentiful, so I don't think it holds your hand as well as you'd think. But I mean, to anyone at the Negative World forums, it probably does.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, and sometimes I feel like playing Mega Man, but I don't feel like trying hard. I just kind of want to listen to the music and blast through the levels. And back when that game came out, I would have fun in easy mode, just kind of jumping around, just being a madman, being like invincible, even though, you know, I wasn't, but like, I'm playing just easy mode, but I still could just enjoy like blasting some guys, you know, without, it's kind of wasting time. You know, letting off some steam, and easy mode was kind of nice for that.
Yeah, I think Epic Yarn, you know, you brought that up. That's kind of an interesting other point, because it's a little bit similar to Wario in that the challenge is kind of self-imposed. If you go for the gold medals, when you fall down a pit and lose half of them in the pit, it's like a fate worse than death for me in that game. You know, I kind of wish I would die and just start at the beginning of the room or whatever, so I had another chance to get those beads back without having to restart the level.
Please just kill me. Moment.
See, but I don't find that I'm that engrossed, I guess, with those kind of games. And I could be talking too generally for my own good. But like Wario Land Shakeout, I still have to finish, because I think I have to collect some more coins to unlock the next level, because I didn't have enough, which is kind of a bummer. So I have to replay some levels just to get coins to buy my next level or whatever.
Yeah, but you're not... Okay, Wario Land is a little bit of a problematic game as an example, because you could grind for coins to unlock levels, but I don't think it's the way it's meant to be played. It's kind of unfortunate that it's possible to play it that way, but if you find if you try to do the achievements, so to speak, you find different paths through the level, you get tons and tons of coins, more than enough to unlock anything in the game, and That I think that's kind of the way it's meant to be played by the hardcore players, and then the kids can just take the little road, like the main path, and not deviate from it, and not really experience the full game, but still get through it.
Do you feel that there's a difference between like collecting star coins in Mario and collecting, you know, the treasures in Wario Land? Because for some reason I find myself gravitating towards the star coins and finding them challenging and fun, and I actually go after each single one of them. But I playing the Wario Land game, I don't find myself caring that much to impose that challenge to myself.
Well, they're kind of in Super Mario 3D Land, the star coins are just platforming challenges, right? And I would say that the treasures in Wario Land are more of like puzzly, if I remember correctly. Well, yeah, exploration, but also like little puzzles to solve, like how do I get through this wall, or like there's
this opening I can't get through. Like, is there another way around? And sometimes, like, you'll have to get squished by a giant rolling rock and like things like that. Like, you have to figure out stuff. So it's not a pure platforming challenge here. So like I wouldn't say that the treasures in Wario Land are the equivalent of the star coins in Mario. I would say more like the achievements that you can do are the main course. Like, they're what the whole hard mode, so to speak, of Wario Land, that's what it resides on.
Yeah, I think the Wario series in general is kind of like that. It's more exploration based than Mario is. And honestly, I could extend that to Yoshi's Island as well. Yoshi's Island, if you just run through the levels and don't worry about the flowers or star coins, red coins, it's quite a bit simpler than if you try to look around and get everything and keep all your stars by the end of the level. And that kind of applies to Super Mario 3D Land. The bulk of the level is what every player is going to see. The star coins are basically little asides tucked away that are, you know, small platforming challenges or, you know, little secrets kind of dotted here and there. In Wario, it's more of kind of the main thing, because the basic path through the level in the Wario games is generally, you know, nothing too complex or too challenging.
Right. Getting away a little bit from platformers, I don't know about you guys, but like this year I've been playing a lot of old school challenging games because of the retro game clubs that we've been doing, like Ninja Gaiden and Castlevania and all games that I never thought that I would actually get through ever when I was a kid. Like, they just seemed like impossible challenges. And it's been really, I've been feeling good about myself for completing a lot of these games. And I would say that a big reason why I play games is to get that little fix of a feeling of accomplishment. Like, sure, I could be, you know, trying to learn a new language or something, but the immediacy of, you know, how rewarding it feels to complete a game is much more attractive to me. But yeah, so that's a big part of why I play games personally, and that's probably why, games that feel like a cakewalk are, they just lose my interest really quickly. But what about you guys? Like, are there games that you can just cruise through and it's not really about the challenge, it's more about the experience, perhaps?
Yeah, I kind of feel that way with, I guess Kirby games kind of fit into that mold for me. But like you, I like really hard games. And I mean, as long as they're, you know, not super cheap, and Ninja Gaiden kind of tested my patience.
Ninja Gaiden.
There's friggin' birds in every level, basically, and that whole send you back to the beginning of 6-1 after the boss.
I cannot believe I got sent back so many times. I basically mastered the first two parts of that last level.
Yeah, same here. I remember getting to that boss without getting hit. Like, I gone through that level so many times, it's ridiculous.
Ninja Gaiden is bad, but Adventure Island is that game for me. Just ridiculous. I hate Island. It so much.
Adventure Island was so hard if you died and you didn't have your weapon in those later stages, and you had to like do this ridiculous. I remember all these spiders everywhere. I don't know. Anyway, challenges are a lot of fun. And what was I gonna say?
I thought the first Castlevania was hard, but even with that Medusa head knight room, I thought it was fair. I thought it was still fair. I mean, the movement, there was a pattern, a very hard pattern.
Yeah.
There was a pattern to it. It wasn't as a stupid, constantly respawning birds.
But, yeah, I mean, like, Simon controls kind of stiffly, but it's built around that aspect of the controls.
Right. But besides Kirby, do you guys have any games that really, they don't offer, like, what about Wind Waker? A lot of people find the combat and the puzzles not challenging at all. But a lot of people still would rank it up there in Zelda series.
Yeah, Wind Waker definitely applies for me. I really was pulled into that world. I love the exploration of it. I love the sailing. I'm not ashamed to admit it. And I really like the visual style and the story. So, I mean, there's a lot to make up for the relative ease of the game for me. But I know it's kind of a controversial game even today.
I suppose so. But yeah, I think you like Animal Crossing, and there's no challenge to speak of unless you're trying to roll a snowman.
it's weird how that game gratifies me, you know, because on the one hand, especially when the game first comes out, I feel lots of gratification too, collecting new, you know, okay, actually, here's what I'm going to say about that, about the difficulty and just the challenges that, Animal Crossing Community.net or .com, one of the two, it was a big fan site. It's still around, and it's got big forums, and I think it tends to have younger players, so I don't really participate in the forums, but they have like entire checklists for your entire catalog, and people trade items, and it's a very community-driven place, and that is what really got me into the Animal Crossing series, being able to check off, like, okay, I've got this entire set of furniture here, or I've got all this music here. The collecting and everything is really great, and building up your house and everything and sharing that with people, that's what's gratifying. It's not so much that I rolled the ball, because the snowball isn't too hard to do, and then, you know, you make a snowman, but hey, look, I got the snowman couch.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say Animal Crossing is an easy game exactly. It's kind of, I mean, it's not easy to get, you know, everything in the game, of course.
Right. I've never done it. I mean, there's just so much. But you do have to, I mean, for like the golden items and everything too, there is some challenge, and I think the series could use more challenge like that, but it's also trying to stay very open and just very relaxed. So it's not trying to impose too much challenge onto you. I think a lot of it is long-term challenge, and that's just particularly different than Mega Man, which is instant, you know, you fight or you die. Animal Crossing, it's, you know, you befriend your neighbors over the course of a week, or, you know, Mabel, who's all antisocial when you first meet her, but if you keep talking to her every day, well, that'll break her down. You'll start learning more about her and everything.
Yeah, I like that subplot.
So Animal Crossing is kind of a little enigma. It's a little bit more akin to what we were talking about a few episodes ago with the just kind of the little tiny tokens of gratification that you get, you know, kind of like with the iPhone games, you know. So the difficulties, and some would say it's endurance, you know, just lasting. I've never actually played one of those games for more than a year. I always end up faltering, but and I think that's just due to the fact that it lacks enough variety over time. Because I do a lot of things right away, and I really enjoy it, but then, okay, well, now I've caught most of the bugs. I have to wait 3 months just to catch the next one, that, you know, or you can time travel to someone's town, but that kind of takes away from it. But we won't digress into a whole Animal Crossing discussion.
Mm.
Not till it's closer, till it's released on 3DS, that I know I'll be bringing it up.
Awesome.
Damn, we'll guarantee it.
Personally, there's one game that's, well, yeah, I mentioned that I was playing Forgotten Sands, and how the so far the game is very much like the, what, six games that came before it? Five? And so I'm not really learning anything. I'm not having a very difficult time pulling off any of the moves. Like, it's very, very smooth and fluid, and it's all stuff that I've done before. And yet I'm still enjoying myself. But it's probably, I'm still in that, you know, the first 2-3 hours of the game. It's still that honeymoon period where I'm still completely blinded by, you know, the game that I'm playing. Yeah, sure. And so like that kind of wears off for me after a while. I've definitely noticed that. It happened with Lost in Shadows, which I also played over the holidays. And the game is, the atmosphere in that game is incredible. And I would recommend everyone to play that game, except I got so bored after like 7 hours, 8 hours of, the game kept introducing new elements, but it never really pushed them very far enough so that I would feel challenged. It would just, I would do one thing a couple of times. The level of difficulty would pretty much remain the same, and then I would move on. And after a while, it just became a little bit too tiring, too tedious. So I'm, Sands of Time, I mean, Forgotten Sands, if the difficulty doesn't ramp up, I just might stop playing, just like I stopped playing Lost in Shadow. But yeah, like it's very weird for me. I need that kind of challenge. Otherwise, I won't keep up with the game. We'll be right back.
All right, so this is the end of the year podcast for us, and so it's natural to look forward to the future, and the future for us is Wii U, and they've promised to release that in 2012, and I really believe that they're going to make good on that promise. In fact, I think it could be here, you know, well before the holiday season even. There's also a lot of concern to be had because the Wii launch was pretty successful, but it still lacked a lot of things. In the 3DS launch, you think that they would have learned from the Wii launch, and it absolutely did not in some aspects. So, you know, will they have a super strong launch at the Wii U? I mean, it's kind of essential if they want to keep their footing in the spectrum. So I just wanted to discuss with you guys what your hopes and expectations were for the Wii U in 2012. And I guess let's kind of think, assuming it comes out between August and November. So if you want to talk about launch window stuff, try to imagine like that to the end of the year, till December, till the holiday season. One major thing that I think is essential, I think they need to have not only a Wii Sports type casual title, but like a huge one to show off what the console can do. They need to have a proper, huge, hardcore, or just a huge franchise game. Whether that's a Mario or Zelda, which of course, with Skyward Sword, that may not happen, and that's fine, but I just don't think that, New Super Mario Brothers Mii? I don't think that will cut it, you know?
Do you think they might forgo this? Because their teams have been very occupied with the 3DS, and of course, a lot of the other teams, like Retro, are still just a year removed from their last game. Do you think they might just rely on the third parties to hopefully fill in at launch?
I think they might have been planning that, but then they saw that that didn't work with the 3DS.
For 3DS.
Yeah, so maybe you're right. Maybe they will see a little bit of latency, but they're trying to get some stuff out. So launch window, as Reggie is such a fan of that phrase. But I feel like they've got tricks up their sleeve, though. Like maybe teams that we don't know about.
Do you think we might actually get a new Mario for launch? Because when I think about it, the last time that actually happened was with a Nintendo 64 launch.
Right.
Which is a while ago. You know, Game Boy Advance, GameCube, DS, Wii, and 3DS, none of them had a true like major Mario game that's new, not a port.
Well, I think if we did, it would be a Galaxy-type game with HD graphics, which I would eat up, and then like gameplay elements that are unique to the tablet or something.
Sounds good to me.
But yeah, I would be really all for that before like their true Mario game that changes how we play games or something, you know. The power they have for us, you know, starved for the HD graphics right now, being Nintendo gamers for as long as we have been, that they could release a Galaxy in HD and we would probably eat it up and call that success.
Yeah, not only that, but I think a lot of lapsed Nintendo fans would actually flock back to Nintendo if they could play like a Zelda game in HD or things like that, like the ones who wouldn't give Wii a chance because of the waggle and because of the lack of HD and how terrible it looks under HD TVs. But I think they can catch get back the lost audience there. But yeah, the tough sell are going to be those casual gamers who flocked to the Wii when it came out.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Wii Sports has a very simplistic design because they weren't focusing on the graphics or the HD graphics. It was standard definition, but it just was simple because they were focusing on the gameplay. And we're not getting new gameplay per se because we've had tablet type stuff with the 3DS and we've had motion control for the past generation. Now is the perfect time to really say, hey, look, this is Mario in HD. You all have TVs for it now. Look how beautiful it looks. You want this console, don't you? You know, that really should be their selling point as much as they might be against that mentality and not trying to.
The question is, can they put that one since EAD Tokyo recently just released Super Mario 3D Land? So do you think they have enough time to come out with another Mario for launch window?
Well, they did do Galaxy last year. I mean, Galaxy 2 last year and 3D Land this year. So I guess it's possible.
Although some people do say that 3D Land's rushed, but I think it's fine. I think it's possible. And I think that they've had people, maybe not even the whole team. Maybe they've been having another team building the framework so that way they can be ready to just kind of go in and just be creative as all hell and just, you know, I mean, who knows how they've really partitioned the resources necessarily. I mean, when we say a game is made by EAD Tokyo are we sure that every member of that team is guaranteed working on that game? Or do they siphon a person here, a person there to kind of get the ball rolling on other projects? And are they there for the entire time? You know?
That was probably true in the past, but we don't really know how much EAD Tokyo expanded. I think Nintendo did go on hiring binge late recently, hiring up veterans. So it's possible that they've been expanded.
So,
yeah, it's also possible the next Mario game, you know, would be handled by EAD. I guess it'd be Kyoto, the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be AD Tokyo.
New Super Mario Bros. Me?
Well, I mean, it could be that one, or it could be, you know, it could be this hypothetical galaxy-like game.
And so, you know, if that, they also could go the route of Pikmin 3 being in HD and being like a, you know, trying to be a system seller. I don't think it personally has the gusto to do it. But I think it would be great to be there at least. I mean, I really think it should be at launch, just as a, here you go, fans, you dedicated SOBs, you know, like, they've been waiting long enough. I think it would be insult to injury to make them wait any longer. And quickly, if I liked Little King Story, would I like Pikmin?
I think you probably would. Okay. I'm a big fan of Little King Story. The combat is similar. It doesn't have the RPG elements, but it does do certain things better than Little King Story.
But there's a lot of cool exploration and puzzle solving more in Pikmin. That's okay. Not really. Well, Pikmin 2 kind of went more combat route, especially in the little caves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely more puzzle solving. I think the controls are more refined in Pikmin.
Okay.
Just maneuvering them around.
And we've yet to have a motion control Pikmin, right? I mean, they didn't even correct, or they did that for the new play
control.
They did
new play control, but yeah.
But it, besides from the ground up, I mean, I think that right. Plus HD could make it as close to a system seller as they can.
Miyamoto has been toying around with Pikmin 3 for a while. He did mention there was only like a handful of people just working on the concept,
mm-hmm.
and that's been going on forever throughout the whole Wii lifespan, so it's possible we can see one pretty soon.
And I feel like Pikmin 3 does have a lot of potential, even though I'm not that big into the franchise or anything, but to have a tablet sitting in your lap and being able to map out or plan certain things with that screen and then using motion control to actually play some of the actions out could be a really powerful use of all of the resources that this system has to offer. And so maybe that could be more of a showcase than I think.
I think Nintendo would try to avoid having you use two controllers at once, though.
Well,
especially like with the Wii, how they tried to, a lot of the games, to try to simplify into just using the Wii remote.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that, I mean, like in, they already showed in the demo with the golf game that they want you to use the screen as well as the Wii remote, you know, so to have it simply sitting on your lap, and you're not going to be using the regular buttons or the joysticks or anything. You'll be using the Wii remote for that kind of thing. I think that they wouldn't have a problem doing that. And I think that we're going to see a lot of that, really, because you're going to have planning out your, you know, football plays or your army tactics. And I mean, that's just a really easy one to think of. But I think that there's going to be a lot of that mixed gameplay, I think. But moving on to some other points, just so I can get them all out there. Speaking of the tablet, I think that they really essentially need to make sure that we have two per console as far as being able to use it. I know that they were talking about one, and there's a rumor that they're working on two. But I don't expect four to happen from what I've heard about how the technology works. But I think two is just a really important thing so that we can at least make some two-player, multiplayer games that have the cool functionality of that. I guess going now into the eShop virtual space, I think it's important that they have an online functional, you know, system right from the get-go. Like, for the love of God, just please get it right off the bat, you know?
you know what the odds of that.
I know.
I'm not giving my hopes. Getting my hopes up.
I know. I'm like wishfully thinking like that so much, but and also I think that they'll do this though is have it easy to transfer your Wii games to your Wii U. I think that they showed it was pretty easy to do with the DS to the 3DS, and they know that how much that'll piss people off. So I think that they're working on that pretty hardcore.
Wait, is that something that's like? Could you actually carry your digital downloads over to the other system?
Yep, from the DS to the 3DS. Yeah, you could.
No, I mean for the Wii to the Wii U.
Yeah, we don't know yet, but we're hoping since it did happen from the DSi to the 3DS.
Okay, yeah, that would be cool. Carry the virtual console games.
And Pogue and I were talking recently too. He was kind of concerned that maybe we wouldn't be able to have the whole virtual console on our Wii U. Like, they might relock games out or something like that. And that would be the one of the most boneheaded moves they could do.
I don't think there's a risk of that. I'm not sure where that fear comes from.
I'm not sure either. But they just need to make sure that they have that, and then perhaps some new ones immediately from the bat. Perhaps just for the Wii U system, you know? Some stuff that really makes us want to go into that shop right away. Okay, really quick, I'm just going to speed through this. That video chat and the drawing programs that they showed in the controller in the preview video, those I think should be there day one. You know, like, give people a reason to use this controller in all the special ways that they want it to be used. Don't make it some sort of gradual thing that people will forget about, you know?
Yeah.
And then having controller apps themselves would be really great. Like, for... I think they kind of did show this a little bit, but for my Wii Fit scale, I should have an app in the controller that I don't have to turn the Wii on for, and I can check my stats on that. Or, you know, maybe you can check leaderboards on your controller without having to touch anything, or check the status of your Animal Crossing town.
That's kind of what they're promising, though, right? Like, the whole idea is that you don't have to turn on your TV, and, like, the Nintendo is talking it up as this big obstacle to people using their Wiis more.
Well, there's not turning on your TV and just displaying that on your controller, and then there's actually not even having to boot up your system.
Yeah, but I'm thinking maybe it's always going to be on, like, in some sort of sleep mode.
Oh, okay. I think it's got to be similar to how the Wii was kind of always on sleep all the time. It's always connected to the internet, but this time it can always have access to a controller. They're always interacting with one, interfacing with one another.
Then I hope they at least have a chargeable dock, because I'm not going to keep buying batteries or, like, having to recharge my batteries constantly because it's feeding it to the...
Nintendo hasn't made a device with a screen that didn't have its own battery pack in a while, so I don't think we have to fear on that front.
That's true. Cool. Oh, you made me feel better.
When's the last time you did that for a non-handheld system? I don't think ever.
No, I don't.
Well, yeah. No, but I mean, like, since the GBA SP, it's had its own power source, so I don't think that Nintendo is going back to batteries for devices with a screen. In fact, it's kind of one of the points I wanted to bring up on another board that I kind of read. They made a big deal about the Wii U's chances against the iPad, and they were saying how much of a big deal, like, how much Nintendo were lagging behind because the screen was in multi-touch. And I find that, you know, like, you had the usual arguments how multi-touch now is kind of expected, and how everyone knows how to use one now, and, like, how Nintendo would look backwards if it didn't have multi-touch. But I don't think that the price is really that much of a deterrent for them for not including one. And I don't think that the uses for multi-touch would be that great anyway in a controller with buttons. But I'm kind of wondering if the weight of a tablet, of a glass screen for multi-touch would be too much in their minds. I haven't seen really this point brought up anywhere, so I'm bringing it up here, and I you know, tell me guys if I'm crazy, but I kind of think that it's probably a big deal, right? Like, Matt, you held the Wii U controller, and you probably remember that it was surprisingly light, right?
Right. Does a multi-touch screen have more weight than a single-touch one?
I'm pretty sure it does. I'm holding my iPhone right now, and it's much heavier than the Wiimote, even with Wii Motion Plus. And I think it's pretty much, like, the glass is to blame here. And also, like, the components, the electronics are probably packed tighter. Oh, yeah.
Is there
and
an
also
iPhone
it's not
without
made of,
multi-touch?
Also, it's not made of plastic, so maybe my argument is not very good.
But I'm trying to see if we can have, like, a constant... like, there's not an iPhone that's not multi-touch, is there?
No, there isn't. Okay. But, like, sure, like, the tablets, the Wii U controllers that we held were wired and probably didn't have a battery pack, so there's going to be that's going to add to the weight of the final unit. But I also think that Nintendo is looking at the weight of the overall thing and probably thinks that adding a multi-touch screen would make it too heavy. And you're not, unlike a tablet where you're pretty much expected to rest that on your lap all the time or on the table, the Wii U controller, you're going to be holding it like a regular controller for a lot of the time. And the whole battery thing made me think of that. Like, do you guys have any opinions or am I crazy?
Yeah, I think it's definitely important that it's light. I just, I guess that's, you know, it's potentially a feature that Nintendo was thinking about when they went with that decision, but it's a little all hard right, to I, say though, just cause I don't know much about the weight of multi-touch glass.
Yeah. And, no one seems really thrilled by my new, epiphany, but,
well, you hear a lot about, the Xbox being so heavy not the controller, but the console itself. And they had the Lunchbox GameCube for easy handling, and the Wii is a pretty small and portable system. I think that they want this to always be portable. Even the Wii U, they want you to bring the Wii U to your friend's house and show him, or, you know, bring it with you to this place. And so the controller, you know, especially if you're going to have multiple controllers and other things to carry, they're going to want to keep, I think, the weight down as much as possible. So I think there's some legitimacy to your comment. I mean, if you look at the system's designed very similarly to the Wii, probably for that same reason. You know, they don't want a bulky machine. They don't want a bulky controller. I've heard a lot about the controller being very lightweight, almost like you're not really, like, enough to where you're holding something, so there's some tactile feedback, but not enough to where it's going to hurt your wrist to hold it for prolonged periods.
Right.
So I think that's possibly an issue, that and then the cost. And also, I mean, maybe I'm not playing the right games on my phone or something, but my phone has multi-touch as well. I have the HTC Evo, and I don't have a lot of use for multi-touch. Like, not a lot of apps use it in any sort of genius ways. So what's it going to matter? And the 3DS is very successful as a single-touch machine, and there's tons of applications to be had there. So I don't think it's their concern.
I think multi-touch mostly comes in toward the whole zoom-out, zoom-in. It definitely makes it a lot easier.
But that's when you've got like shoulder buttons, though.
Right.
Yeah, doesn't matter. That's what I'm saying.
Up and down on the joystick, and then you can pinpoint where you want to focus on it.
You have to remember, like, the iPad and the tablets, they are touch-only devices. They don't have buttons.
Sure.
So they need those multi-touch functions in order to just bring some regular functions that you usually have on, say, a computer into that field.
Right.
So, since we're running out of time for my segment, I just want to say the last few things for beyond launch stuff. Personal wish list, Animal Crossing Wii U should be released within 2 years of the 3DS title. Even though they're similar games, I think they're going to be very different in terms of just how they're executed, you know, being a console version and a handheld version. And so I personally want more. Smash Bros. Wii U, please, I know this is like crazy, but have it out within the first year. Just kind of like they had with...
Okay, you don't want a rushed game? I don't think they've really started it yet, so...
No.
Well, I know, but I'm...
Sakurai is taking his sweet time with Kid Icarus.
It's kind of like, though, I know, that's kind of me saying, like, they should start this second.
Yeah. So and then Sakurai mentioned that they're not going to work... That Smash Bros. Wii U, he's not even working on yet, and if they're going to work on it, it's after Kid Icarus, and he does want to do a 3DS Smash Bros., but that depends on his resources.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, I just don't want to see, like, the console have some long life before we finally get a Smash Brothers game, because Brawl came out so soon in the Wii's life. It would be kind of a shame to see it such a huge gap, you know?
Right. Well, there is a solution, though. Nintendo recently starting doing... is going to start soon doing downloadable content, paid downloadable content for Fire Emblem. So just have like Smash Brothers release at $60 with like 10 characters and like three stages, and just buy each stage and each character for like $2
each. It's the future of gaming.
Or better yet, they actually have it come with Smash Brothers for free, and then you pay for the additional content until the equivalent of $60, which then you would have everything. Which also I don't like that at all either. But going back in the online system really quick, I mean we all want a better online system as far as just being able to meet up with people, etc. I think we all want demos on a more regular basis. And the last note that I have is I don't mind the dashboard system right now. I think it's pretty nice, but I think it could look nicer. I mean, the wall of blocks is kind of it's not that lovely, you know.
Nope.
And I think there needs to be not a single limitation on saving crap to your SD card. Why? I don't understand that at all. Find a way to tie your game saves to allow you to copy your really precious Brawl data, or you know what I mean? Like, it just seems so silly that certain games are locked. Yeah. Unless you homebrew, but it's idiotic. Why? I mean, I know that they're trying to protect the people from piracy, but then they, just like with like serial numbers on a lot of games, and there's a lot of controversy about this for computer games, but like, if you have to have people like dial in to the company and do this and do that, you end up punishing the people who are paying for your product instead of, you know, really stopping any sort of pirates, because they're going to find ways around it anyway. So you're just screwing over the fan base that cares about you. So, you know, find your ways, Nintendo, to protect yourself, but not at the cost of making it a big inconvenience for your customers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my message. Anything
to add? Can't really disagree with that. I don't know, like the whole piracy thing. The Wii was, no, I don't know where I'm going with that. Someone else, pick it up.
You teased that so much. You said the Wii was, and it's just.
Well, I don't know.
Never
like,
know
I,
what it was.
I'm not sure what my point would be. Like the Wii was pirated so early, and I kind of worry about the Wii U if it's pirated early as well. And maybe I'm demonizing pirates a little bit too much. Maybe I'm giving them too much credit or something. But I'm pretty sure that their actions led to fewer hardcore games, let's say, on the Wii, making it over here.
Because of the pirates?
Yeah, like the reduced sales and people downloading Red Steel 2 instead of buying it, and all of that stuff. I don't know, like everyone, it's another can of worms. But
at the same time, like with Xenoblade, you know, they've caused such hoops to be jumped, and now they're getting that game, and they've pissed off the fans, and I guarantee there's going to be a handful of people who just won't buy it here because they're just out of spite going to make a statement with their dollar, or they imported it. And, you know, so, I mean, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't, really. And so, I mean, I think that the GameCube, the small disc, the mini disc thing, was a creative way to combat piracy, even though it had a whole limitation in itself to it. But, I mean, pirates will always find ways to get around your shit.
Right. And well, so, with that in mind, then it's very unlikely to happen, but I would hope that Nintendo would make the Wii U non-region locked, just to save us a whole mess of trouble when they decide not to publish games all of a sudden.
Right. I mean, and doesn't that de-incentify people from pirating games, for instance? Like, say someone doesn't want to take the hassle of importing games, so he downloads it. You know, but if you make it easy for him to get the game, that I mean, that's what you need to do. You need to make it legitimately easy as all can be to get the games that people want to play, because then that's going to deter them. Like, I mean, they proved it with the music industry. 99-cent downloads was easier than trying to torrent stuff, because it was just, you know, oh, it's a big hassle to do this. So I'm just going to pay this for 99 cents. I'm not even going to miss that 99 cents. Bam, I got my song. They got their money, you know.
Yeah, well,
but before, you know, when Napster
we shouldn't get into that.
I know that's a whole other topic. I'm just
So
SD cards should be unlockable, at least them, if they're not going to make the whole console unlockable, which would be another wish list of mine. But so, anything else, guys, or should we just close this up? It's getting pretty late.
Let me finish with: if you use the Makawuhu cheat, I will hunt you down for the rest of the night.
Oh.
Okay, I'm just waiting for E3, basically, for more substantial demos than we've seen. Like, what we've played at E3 was fun, sure, but just proof of concept, and not terribly ambitious proof of concept at that. Like, the whole Measure Up demo, where you had to draw an angle that they asked, or to draw a length, just draw a line of the length required. That's not going to cut it. I'm sorry.
But I think also E3, I'm also looking forward to kind of see Nintendo's direction and what they're going to take. Like, well, that will be a true test to see how much they're focusing on hardcore gamers based on the launch, because that's going to kind of set the tone of the system going forward.
Absolutely.
And also figure out maybe how maybe they'll even push downloadables a lot more. I think they've been pushing it more with the 3DS eShop that they've been than they push did more. With the.
Yeah, but you're saying that you're saying that as a new 3DS owner. You were not there for the first 3 months when there was no store at all.
But I think that point's valid. It seems pretty clear that they're really happy with how they've got things set up with that. So we could see more of that in the future. Now, of course, there's going to be the whole hard drive space situation with the Wii U. Unless they go with SD cards again, but even so, games are going to be taking up a lot of space. So it'll be really fascinating to see what Nintendo does, and it will make or break their future. I don't think that they're ever going to be at the level of Nintendo doomed, but whether or not they actually have a good foothold going into the next generation will be interesting. You know, it's not as secure as it. Like they pretty much had a free ride once the Wii got going, but I hope they realize that they have to try again. They have to win people over all over again, even though they have fans.
Well, I think the Kinect is a nice little wake up call, since that's been kind of biting into the casual market that Nintendo had pretty much a stranglehold on.
And I give a lot of props to Microsoft for trying to truly innovate. You know, they didn't just make a Move controller; they tried to do what Nintendo was doing, but they tried to do it differently, and that I can respect that. And we'll see how that evolves too. That's a whole another topic.
I wonder if we'll see some tablet controller attempts by the other two companies. Do you think we will?
Sony, it's been pointed out that Sony's Vita could act as a PlayStation 4 controller. Of course, it would be a very expensive one, but there is very little that the Wii U tablet could do that the Vita couldn't.
Like all you listeners out there to comment on what you've heard at negativeworld.org. Simply find the thread associated to this episode, and if you don't want to subscribe to Negative World, you can reach us through the Facebook page. You simply have to search for negativeworld.org, or you can reach us on Twitter at @negative_world. And a few little reminders about the site. Secret Tunnel has a thread about the Zelda timeline, so that kind of can go along with what we've talked about today. And with the release of the timeline, it kind of shakes up a lot of the discussion that was, you know, going on before that. So it's pretty interesting right now to take a look. And there's a whole new slew of 3DS owners, like CPA Way. And for that, there's a ton of new friend codes for you to add. And everyone's looking for people to game with. So there's a lot of new people to race in Mario Kart or do this and do that. So definitely go there, add your code to the thread, and add your code to people's 3DSs and have some fun.
Yeah, and if you're not a member of Negative World, you have to sign up to even see those threads. So sign up, people.
That's true, and it takes 2 seconds. It's free. There's a lot of warm personalities in that place. So so come join us, you know.
And you better do it soon while the Christmas tree puzzle and Pushmo is still in season.
Exactly. Something you don't have to sign up for is Matthew's comic, Brawl in the Family. At brawlinthefamily.com. It's a really awesome comic, and he works really hard at it, and there's a lot of them in the backlog, so you'll have lots of content to experience, and I don't think you'll be disappointed if you're a Nintendo fan. The most recent one in particular was really special, and for the end music in this podcast, we're going to actually go with the little song that went along with the comic. It's pretty great.
Mr. Mustache wants us to also plug his Games Within Games, What to Expect in Negative World Communities thread. That post will give you a sample of the fun stuff that the actual members of Negative World do.
Yeah, and Mr. Mustache actually is the one who's backs a handful of those. He's really invested in community aspects, and so he's a great member of the community. And he will encourage that. So you guys should all join him in his plights to play Animal Crossing or
Monster Hunter or Okami or Mario Kart.
So there's a lot of good stuff coming up. And I think it's really fun and unique about this day and age with video games that we all can play games as a community with people who are not in the same room or the same city or the same state. Like, it's just wonderful. So it's really fun to play a game with someone. In fact, I got Pogue to get his DS. I kind of urged him to get that because I wanted him to be a part of our community when we were playing Mario and doing this. You know, it changes it, just like with the Animal Crossing site I was telling you about.
It's fun to send swap notes, too.
Absolutely, which is a whole new crack addict type thing for many of us. And we all try to one-up each other's drawings or say something witty back, and most of us fail. But myself included, I must say. Anyway, but speaking of Mr. Mustache, I also wanted to mention that he helped me with a very successful Negative World Secret Santa that we just did. It was another example of the community aspects here at the site. And so I wanted to thank him and everyone else who was involved. And I know that we all got wonderful gifts and really had a fun time discussing the things that we secretly got from other gamers. So everyone, please update your game database, because that just helps out in all sorts of fun ways. All right, so one final note to mention before we end this thing. We are now offering enhanced versions of the podcast for those who want them. So you can get your normal MP3 download, or you can get an M4A download, which will have chapter markers and photos in those chapters to help you differentiate the different topics we're discussing. It'll make it all around a bit easier to navigate in case you wanted to skip, you know, a spoilerific section and then come back to it later. It's super easy now. Enhanced podcast. You can find it on iTunes. Just search Negative World Podcast Enhanced and you should find it. So, you know, if that's what you're interested in, go for it. Thank you, Guillaume, CPA Way, and Triforce Bun for doing this podcast with me today. I appreciate your time both here and on the boards. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you in about 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
It's beginning to look just like an ice world. Oh, boy, here we go. It's the platformer's greatest foe. Moving around is slow because of all the irritating snow. Yes, it's clear that we're in the token ice world. Arm yourself with rage, for instead of you fighting through, your controls are fighting you through the whole darn stage. You've been through meadows and desert and water and forest and sky, all since level one. Now is the time for your talents to shine as you brave the tundra atop. And slip and slip and slip and slip and fall onto your bum. We're struggling through the cliche ice world. Death-defying jumps, jumps, jumps. Falling icicles hit the floor as you beg and plead no more in this frozen dump.
But actually, it was originally going... they didn't have enough space for it on WiiWare. So then they tried to put it as a retail type. I think they couldn't find a publisher.
Really? That's a shame.
Yeah. I think that was before Super Meat Boy kind of became big.
Right.
Well,
right.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if you can still call it big. Is it considered big?
I think so. It's one of the...
What are we talking about?
Super Meat Boy.
Super Meat Boy, yeah.
It was supposed to be a Wii retail title after it was scrapped as a download, I guess.
Yeah, well, they explored that idea, but they couldn't find a publisher.
Yeah, I already told him.
Yeah.
You miss out on a lot.